Good morning. I'm going to call to order the House Interim Committee on Environment and Water. Welcome to October and welcome to the Capitol. I will begin with a motion on committee rules. Let's have some rules before we move on. I'll open an organizational meeting before we...
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Jensen.
Thank you. I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated October 1, 2009.
Representative Jensen moves to adopt the proposed rules dated October 1, 2009. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barnhart.
Question of staff, I think, except for the obvious difference between session and interim, are there any other changes in the rules?
No, I don't believe there are.
Thank you. I'm ready to vote.
Any further discussion? Sue, will you call the roll?
Representative
Vance?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith?
Excuse.
Vice Chair Jensen? Aye. Chair Pan? Aye. Motion carries. The rules are adopted. And let's, for the benefit of our large online listening audience, let's give quick introductions to this interim committee. We've had one chair. We got rid of that pesky Representative Gilliam, and the speaker, in his wisdom, has made Representative Jensen the co-vice chair, and very glad to be working even more closely with you, Bob. But we have a new member of the committee, and why don't we start down at that end? So just introduce yourself, and we'll come on down the dais.
Jim Thompson, representative for House District 23, which is rural West Valley from Wilmiah Sheridan down to Harrisburg, excluding Corvallis and Albany, which I surround. So the only thing I have surrounded are Corvallis and Albany.
Thank you. My name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the state representative from House District 11, which runs from south of Cresswell, including a sliver of East Eugene, around Springfield, including Coburg, Brownsville, Sotaville, up to the edges of Lebanon and Sweet Home and out to Leeburg. So it's a very interesting district, and I think that I have the best district in the state because I think it's a microcosm of the state with urban dwellers and farm residents and tree lots and a whole variety of other things. I think I was appointed to this committee because I have a very strong interest in our transition to a sustainable energy economy and keeping Oregon clean and beautiful, and I think this committee deals with at least part of those tasks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Bob Jensen. I'm representing House District 58, which is, for the most part, Umatilla County. I have one very small sliver of Union County. There are, however, no constituents in that little sliver of Union County, but it is some of the finest elk hunting country in the state of Oregon. So maybe that's the reason for including that in my district. Thank you.
Representative Ben Cannon, whereas they can talk about their districts in terms of counties, I can talk about mine in terms of streets. I have Burnside and 82nd in Portland and other parts of southeast and northeast Portland.
Beth Petrino, I'm going to be the committee administrator. I was the administrator during the session, and I'm glad to be back.
Jefferson Smith, Multnomah County, and I know every single person in the room.
Cliff Benz, District 60. 26,000 square miles of almost no water. That's why I'm very much pleased to be on this committee.
Representative Jules Bailey, representing House District 42, Inner East Side Portland, the polar opposite of Representative Bence's district in inner southeast and northeast Portland.
By that he means it has a lot of water. It rains
right,
there
right.
more than anywhere else.
Very glad Representative Thompson's on this committee. I get to follow him around because we also serve on healthcare, and we're at this dais last night for that meeting, and we served on the Natural Resources Ways and Means Subcommittee that Representative Jensen co-chaired during session, and really grateful that you have. I'm glad that you're here.
Thank you. I'm glad I'm here too.
And I will miss Representative Gilliam. My understanding is that there were irresolvable schedule conflicts for him given his other assignments. So with that, let's close the organizational meeting and open an informational meeting. And we're going to begin with an update on the one piece of the House Bill 3369 that was passed in 2009. So Phil and Brenda, if you want to come up, we'll get an update on the integrated water resources strategy that was called for by that bill, along with the several other things that that bill did. This, in my view, was one of the most, if not the most significant component of the bill in terms of its potential long-term impact on the state's ability to address water issues. So very interested in the process that you're using, Phil, to get this going, and we'll be undoubtedly following up with this in February and then 2011. So tell us where you're at.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Phil Ward with the Water Resources Department. Just a quick question of clarification. We did come prepared to talk a little bit about what we're doing relative to the other components of the bill, particularly getting the $2.5 million out in the Umatilla Basin. Do you want to brief?
Sure, yep.
Go ahead. Look at that? Okay. We'll do that then. And again, we've been on the road with a number of you in different spots talking about this legislation, so this will not be new, particularly for the folks in this room that helped construct 3369 and make it law. You'll remember there were four components to this bill, the Umatilla Aquifer Recovery Project, and then two different funds, and then the component that the chair just mentioned, the Integrated Water Resources Strategy. So we wanted to talk a little bit about this, the Umatilla piece, particularly because this is something we're moving forward on quickly to get this implementation work underway in the Umatilla Basin. So you will remember that not in 3369, but in one of the companion funding bills, that $2.5 million in lottery-backed bonds was set aside. We had understood from the Treasurer's office that those were not going to be available until May of 2010. We learned just this week that that bond sale is most likely going to move up to December. So Representative Jensen, it looks like we're going to have money available sooner than we thought we would. And so what we have to do to be able to get that money out in the local community is obviously have a little structure in place there locally. And right now there's a local entity in the formation processes. It sounds like something out of a science fiction movie, but it's not a local group forming that we hope will guide the implementation of this project in its next phases, receive the money, and put it to work. So that entity is in the formation processes right now. There are a couple lawyers involved with local folks, and they're in consultation with us.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Phil, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding of this is more or less the formalization of the coalition group that had been working now for about 4 years over there looking at the groundwater and solutions to the problem. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Vice Chair, that is correct. There are a couple of, subtractions from that group, not for any lack of support, but I know there were some entities that have been involved in the coalition that felt like they couldn't legally be involved in this money delivery group. So, but other than that, yes, sir, it's the same group.
Okay.
Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm getting flashbacks as I wrote the note to the chair. Like I imagine, had I been in Vietnam, I might be getting similar ones. But my question is, explain to the committee why we want to give the money directly to a local group rather than have it to the Water Resource Department for you guys to implement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I think a really important question. Our model has been throughout this process, and we did this with the last grant of money that you gave us, is to work through a local group so that there is indeed ownership of this process locally, but to do that through a very detailed and agreed to grant agreement and scope of work, so that there will actually be a local body governing this, but they will be doing that under very specific conditions and a very specific scope of work that the department has agreed to. It's been our thought all through this process that there needs to be local leadership driving this effort. And so far that's been, as Representative Jensen noted, extremely successful through this coalition that's been in place.
Thanks.
Thank you. Go ahead. Okay, so... So here's where we are. We've learned the money will be available probably a little earlier than we thought. So we're scurrying around to help these folks get that entity in place and then to finalize that detailed scope of work. And when that's available, then we will be able to sign with them a grant agreement to release the funds. So again, we had thought we would have to waste the new year till late in the spring, and now we've learned that we're going to be able to move forward more quickly. Go ahead. So here's just the little timeline that we've put together relative to this project. You can see the different activities there. I won't belabor this, but essentially you can see what we've laid out in terms of activity over the next biennium. I'll just touch these really quickly. They're the other pieces in the bill. The Water Investment Grant Fund, as you know, did not have money authorized in 9/11, but we do believe we need to put together some rules so when there is money available for this grant fund, as anticipated in the bill, that we have some of the key issues dealt with. And the bottom bullet there, the peak and ecological flow issue, where the bill requires the department, in cooperation with ODF&W, to protect ultimately peak and ecological flows, is kind of a key concern piece for members of the user community. So we think we need to pay careful attention to this and define by rule what those terms mean very clearly through a scientific process that engages the full stakeholder community. And we've obviously heard that we need to function that way very loudly and clearly from that stakeholder community. And then the water
development. Hang on a second. I figured there might be a question.
Just a question. It's my understanding the department has stolen one of the experts in this field to come on staff. Is that correct? And who is that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, that is correct. George Robeson, who was the senior scientist with ODF&W that designed the peak flow guidance that they use today. When we ask them today on all our water resource permits, what are the peak flows we need to protect in the winter on these water bodies? But George actually designed that process. He has come to work for us. He's now one of our senior engineers in the agency. He's an engineer by training as well as a senior hydrologist, and so he will guide this effort, Representative Jensen, for us.
Are there other ways in which you'll be obtaining scientific input on this question?
Mr. Chair, I think we certainly have not fully scoped out the process here, but we believe that we do need to have the scientific community engaged in this effort, and we'd be happy to report at a later date the specifics in terms of how we're going to do that. But that is something that we believe this needs to be a science-driven process. And so that's our intent, is to engage the scientific community, not just our own resources, in this effort.
Mr. Chair. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You and I and maybe some of the others on the committee have had some conversation already this regard in the IMST. And have you, Phil, had any thoughts or requests, unless you construe what's now being said as a request, for IMST to look at this particular issue?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I've been privy just a bit through some communications with Mike Carrier in the Governor's office about this issue. I know he's corresponded with you, Mr. Chair, on this issue, and I think it's Mike's sense that the administrative agencies need to lead this effort and then engage other entities as appropriate in the process. And so one of the challenges with the IMST, again, as I understand it kind of secondhand, is that they do not have significant resources available to them to launch outside the things that they're already that are already on their work plan. Indeed, they saw some reductions in resources this last session. So our ability to engage them formally might be limited. We'll certainly investigate that as we move along through this process.
Editorialize a little bit in relationship to that. That is correct. They did receive about a third reduction in their resources. However, were it not for perhaps this needs of this project and the interest in maintaining the integrity of that particular branch of our scientific community in relationship to the natural resource and especially the endangered species and area in the state, they wouldn't have had any funding and they wouldn't even be existing, you know, today. So while I have sympathy for the IMST and the fact that their work schedule, you know, may be pretty tight, I am inclined to believe that there still should be sufficient resources there for them to review this particular topic. For those of you unfamiliar with the IMST, that's the Independent Multidisciplinary Science Team, much of which is staffed and housed out of Oregon State University, although all of the members are not on staff at Oregon State University. They come from a variety of sources around the state, and are the thing that is critically important with it, I think, as contrasted to some of the other groups that we might deal with, is the word independent multidisciplinary science team. As contrasted, and no disrespect at all to Mr. Robinson, in your agency, the term independent cannot be applied to him as he approaches the topic, and I think we do need that independent science component there to because we always get into dueling science, as much as we can protect the independence of the information we have, I think it's critically important to us.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative, certainly the IMST's historic role has been one of largely a peer review of activities that the agencies have undertaken. We're certainly happy to contact them and see whether they would be available to do some peer review work for us on this process. Whether they're able to do it or not, we feel like we need to have outside peer review of the product here.
I think Representative Jensen makes a very good point, and I appreciate your openness to it, Phil. Representative Jensen, for those who don't know, was, I think, a big part of the creation of the IMST in the first place, and he's not saying it, but I will, is the reason that IMST continues to be funded today, even at a reduced level, and I also share his concern that the science that informs this process be as, you know, shielded as possible from from, you know, external forces, and really be independent and truly scientific, and again, no aspersions on the work of the department, but there's a reason we created it. It would, I think, bring an appropriate kind of level of credibility and standing to this process, this very obviously controversial process, and sort of my sense of the rulemaking process and what can happen when you get a bunch of stakeholders in the room is you get an outcome that's, well, there may be a scientist there, but you get an outcome that is in some part, you know, politically driven. So the more that we can make sure this is well informed by science, independent science, the better. So really appreciate the points that you've raised, Representative Jensen. Why don't you go ahead with your presentation?
So I think I'm just about done, but again, you would note that kind of the next phase of money that has it at least conceptually been set aside for the Umatilla project are these two potential bond offerings of $10 million general obligations in 2009 and 11, and $15 million in 11-13 in general obligation bonds. And I just wanted to note for you all that that is indeed a part of, as we're building this process, a part of the planning piece, and ultimately we're going to have hopefully a structure in place where this can move should the local community choose to avail itself of this funding mechanism, where this can move seamlessly into that project. So, Mr. Chair and members, that concludes what I was going to talk about in terms of the Umatilla specific work. We'll move to Brenda's piece when you're ready, sir.
Sure. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I feel that standards for borrowers, including repayment plan piece, is of interest to me because of the sad history of the loan fund. And I haven't seen the rulemaking hasn't occurred yet, I don't suppose, but what's your anticipation? Well, how are we going to avoid a repeat?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative, again, I think a very on-point question, because as many of you know, the department did administer a loan fund in the 70s and 80s that ultimately the state had to bail out because a number of the, the repayment wasn't there. One of the things, frankly, that we're hoping the local community will consider is, and one of the reasons, frankly, that we're very interested in having an entity locally rather than individuals to deliver money to, is the ability for a local entity to more deal with this kind of challenge than perhaps individuals at times. So an entity perhaps with taxing authority, certainly with authority to assess its members for repayment, those kind of things are all pieces that we're looking at in this process to ensure we don't end up having to foreclose against an individual grower as we did years ago.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, and it's been my experience that in observing city loan programs that are managed by cities and other things, that that isn't enough. And so, as you point out, the rules are going to have to be carefully crafted and have some sort of professional oversight to make absolutely sure that we are, as a state, adequately secure. Because I know what it's like to have to say no to a neighbor who wants to borrow money. It's really difficult. And so without appropriate state involvement, we could have a difficult situation.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I appreciate that admonition. And just this week, we met with the bond officials from the state of Oregon and our bond attorneys and received some of this very counsel that you've provided to us. And so I guess what I would say in terms of a real positive there is that we're getting great cooperation from the Department of Administrative Service, the Treasurer's Office, and all the consultants community that's engaged with the state of Oregon on bond issuance, and they seem to be just as interested as you, Representative, in making sure we have a structure in place that doesn't fail.
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Three thoughts. With regard to the old loan fund, I think that in addition to making sure we have good standards and good borrowing entities, I think it's critical. And another piece, and the language was chosen to mirror the language in SELP,
So that there's also the issue of making sure there's a manageable enough spread so there's the resources to administer the project and we don't slay the golden goose. And I want to make sure that's on the record and in your head and that we're you know, looking to sell as a model, which is what we tried to do because that's a solvent loan program that's, been lasted over multiple iterations. And, a colleague, Representative Bailey, has, worked with that program. So I wanted to put that on the record. The other is that we are in the process of getting the next stage of the project, that'll give us some more time to gather more facts, and we'll know more. And we should be able to gather more data about what the financial advantages are of the project, what are the environmental realities of the project, etc. And to me, it should not be out of bounds, depending on what happens to the economic situation, depending on what happens to the availability of stimulus dollars, to consider grant funds for the project. And as we do that, what different opportunities does that present for the various state interests if it's grant dollars is distinct from loan dollars? So we want to have that in our heads also as we move forward, that we not just hide-strap ourselves to the facts as we knew them, 3 months ago, but that we also be prepared to understand an evolving landscape.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I again appreciate that encouragement, and I just would, it's certainly the department's intent as well, if we find pieces of this legislation that are not workable from a practical standpoint, our intent would be to bring that to you in the future for consideration. So I think we share those views that we may need to make some revisions down the road, and if we do, our commitment is to identify those and bring them to you in a timely fashion.
Thanks. Brenda, 10 minutes on Integrated Water Resources Strategy.
Yes, sir. Good morning. My name is Brenda Bateman. I'm with the Water Resources Department, and this morning we wanted to talk about two specific documents that we've recently drafted and made available for your review and comment, and they're also open for public comment at this time. The first is the preliminary work plan with regard to the Integrated Water Resources Strategy. I've provided a link here, but you should also have hard copies in front of you for perusing later. We, as I mentioned, we're in public comment now through the end of the month, and any comments we receive during that time period will be prepared and brought to our Water Resources Commission when they next meet in November. In this work plan, you'll find brought together for the first time in one document many of the definitions and clarifications and visions that we've talked about earlier with this regard, but you'll also find a more specific timeline and information flowchart, which I have on the following slides. This timeline, which is also in your work plan, has more detail there in the hard copy. But generally, you'll see we've identified five phases that we plan to move through between now and the year 2012, which is when the first edition of this strategy is due. Right now, we're in stage one, where we're putting together some of the background documents, developing the team, and appointing policy advisory group members and other foundational pieces that we'll need as we move forward. I just wanted to briefly show you this information flowchart. It's quite a bit on one page, as you can see, but I wanted to draw your attention to the project team that's there in the middle box and let you know that from the three agencies that are discussed in the bill in terms of managing this project, I will be part of the project team, leading the project team, and there will also be Christine Spetkovich from DEQ and Bruce McIntosh from ODF&W, who are serving really on the day-to-day operational piece of this. And then I also wanted to point out the boxes across the bottom here, and they're on the following slides, a bit more detail. The first is a discussion of public process. We're in the middle of designing that, but what we have so far is that we've interviewed about half a dozen firms who do this for a living, and we've been strongly encouraged by them to make sure when we have some of our larger meetings that we bring in independent facilitation to really create the space so that folks feel safe participating so they can share their ideas and opinions as part of this process. But we've also been real careful to make sure we have opportunities set up either face-to-face or electronically for comments and two-way communication with folks. We've set up an email address specifically for this project. We also have a listserv. Some of you may have received from us just a few days ago a one-pager, just the beginnings of the description of this project. We'll try to do that regularly. If you didn't receive that, please let me know and we'll make sure we get you on the listserv. But that's another opportunity for folks to sign up and get updates as we move through. And finally, we're visiting with associations and their boards and memberships throughout the rest of this year in preparation for some larger meetings probably next year, spring or summer, thereabouts. The other two pieces that I wanted to point out are the discussion of a policy advisory group and a technical advisory group. Right now, the directors of the three departments, WRD, DEQ, and ODF&W, are in discussions about this group that would have about 15 or so members, citizen members, representing a variety of interests and geographies, and they would be appointed by the directors. We're hoping to have them on board in 2009, and the main goal here is to have a group of folks who can help ground truth the process as we move through it, can ask and answer questions within their own communities, and ultimately serve as champions of the process. We also, though, know that we're going to need some technical advisory groups, again, jointly appointed and probably convened as needed, to specifically address some scientific and technical questions. We talked a little bit earlier about the idea of peak and ecological flows. Those types of questions that will need very specific groups and conversations will be convened as we move through this process. And the second document that I wanted to draw your attention to is a set of draft issue papers that basically function as a problem statement for this entire project. It's really a statement of why we should even be paying attention to these issues now, why we should care. And those also are available on our website and in hard copy in front of you. We'll be taking comments into year 2010, and that's primarily because there are several topics within these papers. One of them, the ecological paper, has not yet been drafted, and that will be ready in November. So that pushes our comment period a little bit further into next year. Next steps that might interest you will be to finalize those issue papers into 2010, to appoint policy advisory group members, to continue our outreach with this one-pager and others like it in the coming weeks and months, and possibly even put together an RFP for help getting some facilitation for those larger meetings so that we can prepare for those in 2010. And I'm happy to take any questions you may have.
Brenda, is it possible that you will be far enough along to have recommendations for legislation by 2011, or if those are to come out of this? And I realize that's not the primary purpose necessarily, but one can imagine that this strategy development would identify some barriers or opportunities that would require coming to the legislature for funding or for legislation. Is it possible? Should we have that on the our radar screen for 2011 or not?
Mr. Chair, I think it's quite possible that those types of obstacles and pieces will start to take shape. What I'm anticipating is that we may end up with quite a list that we'll need to spend some time in 2011 paring down and prioritizing, because I imagine that we'll get quite a few good ideas and that we'll just need to make sure we've got our priorities and resources ready to go. So it's definitely a possibility.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I just would add, I think we'd anticipate some budget items relative to this growing out of this initial phase. And again, if there are tweaks to existing program and statute, then we would want to identify those. Again, the first iteration of the project's not due till, or of the plan is not actually due till 2012, but we do want to be sensitive to things that rise quickly to the surface, both from a budget and structural standpoint, if we need to address things of that nature. Yes, sir.
Questions, Representative Smith?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think I can at least speak for myself and for Representative Jensen at this point, and maybe for other members of the committee, that we there's an interest in over time, and sooner rather than later, if all, you know, depending on economic situation, to spend real money on water projects in Oregon, right? And that I think that we want to kind of keep good faith with that intent and not think, okay, well, we you know, figured something out and said, well, wouldn't it be nice to do it in a larger context, but then we never really resolve the larger context. So I want to put that out there and be explicit about it. And so that's thought one. Thought two is, I do think we want to continue to consider the question of the loan, you know, of loans as the best mechanism for this project, and be grown-ups about it. I mean, look at it and say, okay, is this the this might be the most fiscally responsible, most sustainable, best way of doing it over time. But I do hope that we'll continue to evaluate the facts, look at other states, see what is there, and see what the mixture of grants and loans ought to be. See what our financial situation is. I don't think that's anything new, but I do want us to again kind of keep fluid in thinking about that and being smart financially.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just respond quickly. Sure. I agree with that, and certainly Oregon has not had perhaps the same history of some of our neighboring states in the West in actually investing in this type of effort,
right?
Community-wide effort, again, in some of the other states. So I think we need to keep our eyes open as to how to do that effectively, and I think it's the department's job to bring, you know, our findings back to you all for your consideration as the ultimate policymakers.
Great. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The challenge for the department is to take this process and actually make something of it, and it's, I must say, as I read through what you've prepared so far, it's hard to move away from the rearranging the deck chairs and actually move forward. So when I look at this, I'm just struck by, there's some underlying assumptions that are built into that which I'm now looking at. One of them that I see right away is that there's an assumption that we need more water in stream for ecological purposes. There's nothing said about the value of the water being used out of stream. And as we watch California dry up and economic opportunity progress northward to us because we have water, this economic opportunity piece needs to be more clearly stated in what I'm looking at, because it's huge. And it's certainly something in our current situation we need to be cognizant of, and it needs to be here. It's not. What this reflects, when one glances through it, as I just did, because I just got it, it's clear that the focus is on in-stream issues and fish species, all important matters. But the assumption then is that there's some lesser value of the water out of stream. And I know that Representative Smith and Representative Jensen's efforts prove otherwise in trying to store water out of the Columbia. But so that's one point. The second one is that when we talk about an integrated resource strategy, that's a big bunch of words. And what it boils down to is how we're going to slice up this limited resource. We already have a system that does that, the prior appropriation doctrine. And so when we go in now with this integrated strategy, it's a movement toward a new allocation system, no matter how many nice words we put with it. So I'll be watching and anxious to see how you're going to more clearly state what I just said, because integrated strategy is a bunch of words, and I'd rather say reallocation, because that's what this really is. It's a means of trying to do it in a most difficult circumstance. So, and I know the words in here say just the opposite, but there's no other way around it. That's what we're about. We've got limited water. How are we going to use it? And how we're going to make those decisions. And that's what you're about. So, and now, we can keep on using the word integrated. And I was mentioning to Beth earlier how many times I've heard that phrase over the 25 years I've been working on this stuff. Good luck. And I will be involved in your process.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I attended part of one of your commission meetings during the last session, and I think you were dealing with, in fact, some components of this, what this bill is kind of trying to get at. And I guess the question I'm asking you is, where are we in sync, or where are we out of step with where the commission was at or is at, and where they want to go in relationship to this whole issue of integrated water policy in the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I think the ultimate product that the legislature produced, the commission is fully on board with, and are deeply engaged in this process. So I would say there's a fair amount of syncing up. Yes, sir, if I'm responsive to your question.
And I, if I could follow just a half a second on it, I'd like to kind of make a special request that maybe if and when the commission is going to be discussing issues in this area, that you might let members of this committee know so that, that if it's possible for us to attend to hear what's going on at your boss's or your other boss's level, you know, in relationship to this, so that we're not getting too far astray in the legislature from, you know, where that commission who spends, and I know Representative Bent spent a long time, you know, working on that commission, but where they're at, where they want to go, and what they're doing type of thing. So that's just kind of a personal request for you.
Happy to do that, Mr. Chair, members. And if I might, Mr. Chair, just respond briefly to Representative Bence, just very really briefly. So I want to be responsive to your admonishment there to make sure we pay attention to the economic end. I think we've been criticized for paying too much attention to that end as well. So we need to make sure that, that our verbiage is clearly inclusive, but certainly from the department standpoint, we see the economic piece as critical and of equal value.
Thank you, Phil, and I think you're off to a fine start with this. It's interesting in hearing Representative Bence's comments how with sort of somewhat different colored glasses on, we read these documents and different things stand out to me. When he mentioned rearranging the deck chairs, I immediately looked at this statement about very clear intention not to overhaul Oregon water law, clear intention not to lay out a plan that reallocates water, and I look at the challenges and read about the challenges that we face related to water quality, quantity, climate change, etc., and say, well, but this process isn't going to, and I understand for political reasons to help bring people to the table, but also seems to be saying there are real limits on where we're going to go in terms of recommendations here, no matter how compelling the story is around the need for reasons of in-stream or economic reasons or others to make significant changes. So, I mean, my concern is also that you're rearranging the deck chairs, but from a obviously somewhat different perspective. So you're clearly in the middle of this.
We are, Mr. Chair, and we didn't want to burden this process from the outset with an expectation that we were going to blow up Oregon water law as it currently exists. I sincerely believe that there are significant opportunities to meet Oregon's water needs in the future. We, unlike many of the states in the West, do have a tremendous water resource available to us. It's a matter of timing and ensuring that when we save winter water, that we protect those fish values. So we think from conservation to new supply development, many of the things that we think you all anticipated in this piece of legislation last session, that there are opportunities to build a system in the years ahead that still honors the time-tested system of water distribution in the West.
Thanks very much, Phil.
Thank you.
We've got a great opportunity now. I think it's a nice segue to some real, live, on-the-ground water work from the Deschutes Basin. And members of this committee during the last interim, of which I am the only one, of the Environment Committee from the last interim,
really?
Spent some time working on the Deschutes issues. And Doug, if you want to come on up with Mayor Wendell, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for making the trip. Glad you're here. We thought we'd have you all by video conference, but it's nice to have you actually here. And sorry that we don't have much more time, given the distance that you've come to spend with us today. So thanks
thank
for being
you.
Here.
Thank you very much, Chair Cannon, members of the committee. My name is Mike Wendell. I'm mayor of the city of Prineville. And I got to tell you, first off, I really wasn't planning on seeing Patrick Griffith from the city of Bend that large right now. A little too early in the morning to see him. So, just to give you a quick
I thought
update.
That was a PowerPoint presentation.
I really did. He's so still. He hasn't blinked. There he goes.
All right. Thanks very much. Great. That's what we need. Thanks.
We actually have a video link.
We do. And
we have joined the 20th. I mean, the
early 21st
century. Yes. And welcome to our, thanks for joining us by video, gentlemen, and we'll get to your introductions in a moment. Thanks.
Real quick, a little bit of history of COCO, Central Oregon Cities Organization. We've been around for quite a while now. We were originally started because of water and water quality issues, supply issues. We've been at it for quite a while. Recently, 2005, House Bill 3494, we were asked to make a presentation on progress that we've made in 3494. So we have on the video conference with us Patrick and I believe Todd Heisler with us to help us out. So if you have any questions, ask them, because they're the ones that know everything that's going on. All right? So at this time, we'll introduce Patrick. Patrick, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me okay?
Yep, we can. Go right ahead.
Terrific. Again, Patrick Griffiths. I'm the Water Resources Coordinator with the City of Bend. I'm sitting here with Todd Heisler, the Executive Director of the Deschutes River Conservancy. We're going to split up our presentation. We're going to try to go as quickly as we can so we can leave a little time for discussion. I just want to say, Mr. Chair and representatives, we really appreciate the discussion that's already occurred, and I have to say, we share the same water shortages that Representative Bentz mentioned a little bit earlier. So I'll get right to it. Some of the key issues we're working on in the Deschutes, the framework that we're working with includes the following. There's really no new water to allocate in the Deschutes Basin. And so it speaks to exactly what Representative Bentz just said. We're going to have to create what we like to think of as new water from existing uses and give it to where we think it is most deserved, and that is whether it's in-stream, new ag, new municipal, or other uses. We are facing the increasing regulatory complexity that I think is a Western-wide issue. We know that water quantity is the foundation for water quality solutions. We also have a special issue in the Deschutes that there's no new groundwater unless you mitigate for that groundwater use. We have a hydrologically connected system, and I'll come back to that. We also know that water for mitigation is going to come from existing uses, and that will change because of a couple different things. We're looking at large-scale efficiency projects in conservation. We're also looking at changing land uses. As our UGBs expand into irrigated areas, some of that water may get released with cooperation from the region. But my last bullet on this first slide is probably the most important, and that is, we need to create the institutional capacity to deal with these tough discussions. We have we're coming to you from the OSU Cascades campus in Bend, up at the COCC campus. And one of the things that you need to know about is there's an expert on OSU, Dr. Aaron Wolf, who does international water conflict research. And he just published a paper that came out. It doesn't directly apply to our situation, but the key point was in his paper is, most conflict over water issues comes because the institutional capacities cannot keep up with the change. So let's talk about three things we wanted to let the committee know about that are really the most changing drivers that we're facing today. Number one is the House Bill 3494, which put our groundwater mitigation rules in place, is coming up for a rulemaking here. According to the director and the department, that rulemaking is going to happen starting sometime this fall. And that rulemaking is going to just take on the issues that we worked out collaboratively in the work group that we reported to the legislature in January. So we're looking forward to making some minor small changes to the rules. But one of the recommendations in that 3494 report was a broader action, a suite of actions that would be a little bit more integrated. And so that's one of the things that we're going to be working on. The second point, we're faced with more federal regulations. We have listed steelhead now released above the Pelton Project, which is a PGE and tribal project. And those listed species are causing a lot of folks to be worried about liability issues, both at the irrigation district level, municipal, and others. We're faced with Safe Drinking Water Act issues. The City of Bend now must face the LT2 rules for cryptosporidium in our unfiltered watershed, very similar to the Portland issues. And the cities and counties are looking at doing a study or finishing up a study on our ESA liabilities related to steelhead and also looking out in the future if other species get listed. The third bullet that Todd will talk about here in a moment is we're starting to take on that institutional capacity issue. And we're forming the Deschutes Water Alliance, or reforming it with a new memorandum of understanding. And we're really focused on two things right now. And one of the outcomes of that will be a Umatilla-like project that we'd like to work with the department on, is how to work with our water bank and expand the pilot project that's been working successfully to allocate water over the last 4 years into a broader program, if that's something that works. And also, Todd's going to talk a little bit about the conserved water projects that are going on in this basin that are really putting a lot of water back in stream at the time. So if you flip to the next page, there's a quick map of the Deschutes Basin. That's what it looks like. Our water flows uphill on the page, north, and dumps into the Columbia. The gray shaded area in the bottom left quadrant is the groundwater study area. That's the area that if you drill a new well today, you must mitigate for that new use. So that's what we call our study area. It doesn't appear on any of the department's maps as a critical area of concern, but we like to think of it as it's critically connected. When you pump groundwater in the upper basin, the scientists tell us that there will be an effect in the lower river, and that's the part that we're mitigating for under the Scenic Waterway Act. Moving along to the next slide, the groundwater mitigation rules were put in place to deal with the water quantity issue. And so we want you to know our program is working. We feel that working with the department on this has been great. We've had a lot of successes there. The rulemaking process is going to get started here shortly. But again, we need to take on that regional approach, and that's what the DWA is going to be about. A couple of concerns in the existing rules. They sunset in 2014, and there's a 200 CFS cap, which basically limits the amount of water development that can happen in the future in our basin. Right now, that cap has been reached in application. We understand from the department there's less than 3 CFS remaining under that existing cap. That's a de facto moratorium on development. Two other issues there. The rules as written were never intended to solve water quality problems. They were specifically dealing with 1% and 1 CFS in the Scenic Waterway Act, which is just about flow. And so again, those rules were put in place using the typical silo approach, dealing with just the Scenic Waterway Act, and kind of ignoring all the rest of the issues that are in a complicated basin such as the Deschutes. Quick update on the Endangered Species Act. Again, if you're not familiar with the Deschutes, we have a large hydroelectric project smack dab in the middle of the basin at River Mile 100. That project is a series of 3 dams that are owned in partnership with PGE and the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. They recently got a new 50-year license from FERC, the Federal Licensing Agency, and included in that license was they needed to reintroduce listed species above the project. They're investing millions and millions of dollars to do that. Well, there's a ripple effect into the rest of the basin on that for flows for fish that are being reintroduced. Those fish are now swimming in Lychus Creek in the Crooked River and the main stem Deschutes below Big Falls, just above the project, and they were released this year and the year before. The irrigation districts are dealing with their liability issues by beginning a habitat conservation plan. And that plan is they're working with the federal agencies to figure out what their liabilities are and begin to study how their operations can be changed in order to deal with this liability. The cities and counties came together and hired a consultant, and we are also working on a risk assessment project. That's going to be out in late October, and we'd certainly like to get a copy to the legislature when that becomes available. So let's talk specifically about that. The activities that the cities and counties are looking at include stormwater, transportation activities, water diversions, both surface and groundwater, land use and zoning, and any local rules, ordinances, and policies and practices that can help protect the species that are in discussion. So essentially, if you move to the slide that says meet basin needs, we do, and we are using that word integrated here, and I think there's a piece of that that there's some cost efficiencies. If we can work on these issues together, we look at this as efficiency is multiple benefits across all of these areas, Scenic Waterway Act, Safe Drinking Water Act, Clean Water Act, ESA, and the various land use laws that tell the cities we have a 20-year obligation to plan in coordination and have a duty to serve these cities as they grow. And that's what the Deschutes Water Alliance is really trying to get together and talk about. And with that, I'll turn it over to Todd Heisler.
Thank you. So I'm Todd Heisler, the Executive Director of the Deschutes River Conservancy. Thanks for this opportunity. I'm going to just touch on some of the issues that Patrick just raised. We're going to drill into the Deschutes Water Alliance for just a moment. So on this chart, what you can see is that most of you have heard about the Deschutes Water Alliance because we formed it under a federal grant in 2004. But what's different about the current effort is that based on really the challenges that we continue to face that Patrick just described, we figured we needed really to bring the counties into this equation, and we also needed to take it beyond a staff level. Most of the work was done at the staff level with the tribes, the DRC, the irrigation districts, and the cities. And now we felt it's very, very important for elected officials, local governments, to really have a forum to come together and discuss this at the elected level and be informed by some of the studies that we've done, but also to ask their own questions and for us really to work together to try to resolve some of these ongoing issues of water. So on the next page, you'll see the original mission. This has not changed from 2004, and it basically says that we should be able to have water for urban communities, to sustain agriculture, and for water quality for the benefits of fish, wildlife, and people. And we like to hold these goals all together as one set of goals. We do not like to look at them as competing. In fact, if we're to be successful, we have to be able to hold all three, not as competing goals, but as ones that we want to reconcile and trade off and try to optimize all three. And in a minute, I'll tell you some of the progress we've made actually towards achieving these objectives since we've been at it now about 5 years. The next slide really summarizes what we believe are the local government interests here for a local government forum. And I want to underscore local government in that this is not intended to only be local government. Obviously, there are state agencies involved, there are federal agencies, there are other NGO stakeholders. But we wanted to create a place where the local governments could come together and discuss their own issues. And we believe those are drinking water supply, the health of the river, federal regulation that Patrick just mentioned, maintain recreational assets, both flat water and whitewater, and sustaining agriculture, one of the historic underpinnings of the economy here in Central Oregon. And the newer one on the horizon is to produce hydropower. These are all things that the local governments have told us that are really important. So we know that we need a regional solution. We are essentially here trying to balance these different interests and come up with a set of projects, programs that we can deliver to address these things at a regional scale. As we have gone forward to work on all of these issues, what we recognize is that it, in some ways, of course, it is a redistribution of water as you move it around. And as you do that, you cannot move water from one place to another without affecting some other part of the basin or some other interest group. So really the only way for us to get our arms around a balanced solution is to have really a long-term regional integrated water management strategy. And we think it is really important to do that, to really create assurances for all the stakeholders and for all of us to be able to work together towards these common objectives that we have set that everybody cares about. We also are very concerned about losing local control. We don't want to end up in a Klamath situation where federal authorities come and tell us how to manage the water locally. We like more the Umatilla model, where unified voices in a locality and a region in Oregon have been very effective in leveraging resources and support for their projects.
And Todd, so if you could finish up in just a couple of minutes, that would be great.
Okay, I will certainly do that. So the DWA is circulating an MOU. We are, as I said, getting elected officials to sign on. We're going to have our first kickoff meeting on October 12th. Representative Walden and Phil Ward will be keynote speakers at that. And really, this is being convened by Deschutes County, and Alan Unger will be our facilitator or master of ceremonies, if you will. So the last three slides, let's look at really fast. These indicate what has been accomplished over the last 4 years. We have been, one of the great ways to provide benefits for agriculture and for in-stream irrigation conservation projects, which we have taken on in Swallow Irrigation District, Three Sisters Irrigation District, Central Oregon Irrigation District, Tumwater Irrigation District, they are planned for North Unit, and others. We have restored, or will restore with this winter's work, over 50-60 CFS in our rivers and streams through these projects while delivering water to the farmers. The water bank that Patrick spoke about has been extremely successful, although it does need some help still. But we have managed to put 1,000 acres of water rights in stream for the benefit of cities and restoration. Most of that water has been converted for mitigation transfers, for mitigation credits, about 3/4 of it. And about 19 CFS has been restored as a result of that. And the last chart really shows you the irrigation districts, the restoration and mitigation efforts in the Deschutes, showing great benefits for our streams while helping to meet our both ag and drinking water supply needs for the cities. So we've done a lot. We need to really get a plan together to understand how to integrate these tools better and to assure that we take care of everybody as we move forward with this kind of program in the Deschutes. Thank you for your time.
And thank you, gentlemen, both for joining us. We have time for just a minute or two questions. I have to note this is the first presentation on this topic that I haven't seen the famous Deschutes whale. I hope that's because it's changed shape so much in the years that you guys have been working that it's no longer relevant. What are the best remaining opportunities? The water's fully allocated. There isn't. So what are the best opportunities for new water, remaining opportunities for new water? Obviously, you've new in quotation marks, but obviously you've done a lot. What remains?
Patrick? I think some of the biggest opportunities right now are twofold. One is working in conjunction with the existing irrigation districts to work on that thorny issue of urbanizing lands. How do we deal with the assessment issues? How do we deal with the farming issues? How do we make sure their junior rights are respected as we convert some of those rights to possibly mitigation or in-stream or both? The second big opportunity we have in the Deschutes, you recall that when all the irrigation canals were built and the water rights were given out, about 50 to 60% of the water they divert out of the Deschutes River is allowed transmission loss, getting it to their points of use. And so that 50 to 60% of that irrigation loss, that transmission loss, could become available to reallocate, both for in-stream use, for cities, and others. But we haven't created the perfect mechanism yet to make sure that we're meeting those needs incrementally as we move ahead. We don't want to push this problem off to our children. We want to deal with it today, and we want to share money and resources to do that, both with state funding and federal funding. So there's the real big opportunity that we have right now. We also have two other opportunities, reservoir reoperation. We know there's a lot of slop in the system that can be fine-tuned as we do some more modeling and better understand that system. And then certainly there's urban conservation and on-farm conservation that are going to be part and parcel with the larger conservation projects on the canals and on the laterals.
Thank you.
If I could add to that, I would also say that, as Patrick said, you know, we look at them as opportunities, not as challenges. It's been an interesting discussion with everybody in the room, all the opportunities that we've been able to look at, and everybody at the table with the Deschutes Water Alliance has been supportive of going forward with this process, so it's been good for us.
Mr. Chair, I just want to thank the members of the committee who have been over to Central Oregon. We had Representative Jefferson Smith out with Judy Stiegler last week. Seeing is believing, I think, and many of you have been there before, and we appreciate you coming over and extend the invitation for any of you who are in Central Oregon. Give me a call and we'll set up a tour of the diversions and the piping projects and take you to Whites Creek and see the good conservation efforts going on out there.
Well, appreciate all the good work and the update to this committee, and look forward to being able to take advantage of that offer again soon. Representative Smith, last question.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. No, I just wanted to say thanks for the time, and also that, and I know we wanted to move from the last topic to this one, but I think as we look at statewide water needs, and I think all too often there is the, you know, irrigators versus fish, you know, sort of dual challenge. And the visit to the Deschutes Basin and also understanding in previous and hopefully future work that it's not merely that, it is also sort of the needs of, you know, current Oregon citizens generally and future Oregon citizens, that which includes both rural and urban and municipalities and counties, and that in fact, Patrick, I think some of your thoughts about how do we think about water resources for the future 50 years, for the future 20 years, how can we use public expenditures to create good out-of-stream uses now, protect the environment, and put us in a better position than we otherwise would have been 50 years from now. And if we can get all three wins, not just a win for fish or just a win for current out-of-stream use, but both of those and a win for future Oregonians, I think that's the way through, and I want to keep on hammering away at that until I perish. Which might be sooner rather than later.
It's a long time for coming. Thanks, Doug. Thanks, Mayor, and really appreciate the fact that we were able to make this connection work, and you guys got over to the college there to make it happen, so thank you. Let's move quickly into our discussion of federal and state stimulus dollars and their work on water and energy projects. We have representative from the governor's office and from DAS.
Okay. I'm well, if I can get the computer going. It's been locked. What do I do? The computer says it's locked. Only administrator can unlock it. Not me. I'm sorry, do you have a jump drive?
Oh,
so I hope that over the course of this, 25, 30 minutes, we'll get an update both on some of the federal projects or federally funded projects that are taking place here, but also on the investment that the state legislature made, and I think that may come from you on water and energy projects. So I'm going to cover both those topics. Work briefly.
I'm getting there. Yeah. Oops. Okay. Good morning, Chair Cannon. My name is Jane Bakary. I'm a Natural Resources and Energy Program Manager for the Governor's Economic Recovery Revitalization Team. I'm going to give you an overview today of the Federal Recovery Act monies that are coming into Oregon for natural resources projects, including water and energy projects. And it's a pretty high-level overview. I'm also going to give a very brief overview of just the Recovery Act in general to provide context so that you can understand how the money's coming into Oregon and how it's being spent. Feel free to ask questions during the presentation or afterwards. So in Oregon, we estimate that, nationally, $787 billion will be spent through the Recovery Act over the next 3 years. This includes $288 billion in tax relief, $224 billion in entitlements, and $275 billion in contracts, grants, and loans. This money provides direct assistance and benefits to individual Oregonians through existing programs, tax incentives, and these include programs like Medicaid, food stamps, financial aid, unemployment benefits, and also provides some assistance to the state government to fill state budget deficits. An example of this would be the state fiscal stabilization funds that our Department of Energy is receiving. It also provides some additional state funding through existing programs. Examples of this would be the state energy program,
also the state revolving funds that are set up for clean water and for wastewater programs. And it does provide some direct opportunities for local communities and cities. Examples of these funds include the Energy Efficiency and Conservation Block Grant programs that are direct allocations to the cities. What the Recovery Act does not do is it does not provide seed or venture capital grant opportunities. It does not provide direct money directly to the governors of the states to allocate at their discretion. It does not fill Oregon's current budget deficit completely. It does not allocate all of the money in one lump sum. The funding opportunities are staggered over 3 years. And there is not one deadline for all the applications for all the programs. Each program is different with different application deadlines and different guidance. So there's four different types of funding opportunities available through the Recovery Act. There's, as I mentioned, direct benefits to individuals. There's also program funds distributed through the state of Oregon. We refer to these as formula funds because there's a formula set up for each state. And through existing programs, that formula is used to figure out each state's allocation. There's also opportunities for vendors and for contractors. These are opportunities directly through the federal agencies, through the state, and some of the money that we'll be distributing, and also through some of the recipients that will be receiving Recovery Act funding. And then there's competitive funds that are distributed through the through various federal agencies. So just a little graphic about where these formula funds are going in Oregon. We estimate that Oregon will be receiving about $3.9 billion. And as you can see from the graph, most of this is going to Health and Human Services. Energy and Natural Resources is receiving about $130 million in formula monies. There is quite a bit of oversight set up for the Recovery Act. The White House did set up the Recovery Accountability and Transparency Board. There's also the Office of Management and Budget is providing guidance to help us interpret the different provisions of the Act and how we need to implement them. And we hear a lot about accountability and transparency with the Recovery Act. Right now, we're thick in the middle of the Section 1512 reporting. The first reporting deadline for the Recovery Act is October 10th. This is for the first quarter, but also includes all the funds that were awarded since the Act was signed in February. So we'll be working on that. Our office is central reporting for the state of Oregon. So Oregon, along with several other states, is doing central reporting to the federal government for the Recovery Act money. We have to report quarterly, and that reporting is done cumulatively. OMB has set up guidance on how we need to do this reporting, including the different data points that we need to report on, such as the amount spent, who's getting it, the jobs created and retained. And also, we need to report as a prime recipient. Subrecipients and vendors also need to report. And we will be reporting centrally for all the money that comes directly to the state through formula funds. So I want to talk a bit about, and I think this is probably what you're more interested in, where the money is coming for projects in Oregon related to natural resources. I'm going to talk a lot about water and energy, but then I'll talk a bit about some other environmental projects that are receiving Recovery Act money. So for formula funds coming into Oregon, the Clean Water State Revolving Fund, which is administered through DEQ, is receiving $44.2 million in formula funds. This is an additional capitalization of the state revolving fund, and at least 20% of this money must be used for projects that address green infrastructure or energy efficiency and or water efficiency types of projects. And this is called the Clean Project Reserve Funding. And as you probably know, the SRF program provides low-cost loans to communities for water quality and wastewater infrastructure needs. Similarly, the state is receiving $27.8 million for the Safe Drinking Water Revolving Fund. This is also an additional capitalization of this fund. This fund is administered through the Business Oregon and in partnership with the Department of Human Services, and that money is also from EPA. The DEQ is also receiving a Water Quality Management Planning Grant from EPA that's almost $500,000, and this is to do some water quality project planning throughout the state. And then DEQ is also receiving $2.7 million for the Leaking Underground Storage Tank Cleanup Program, and that's also through EPA. For energy-related projects, the biggest chunk of money is coming through the State Energy Program to the Oregon Department of Energy, and that's $42 million. ODO is in the process of reviewing and determining how that money, or the initial half of that money, will be allocated. A couple weeks ago, they just announced the first 22 projects for that money. That money is primarily for energy efficiency and conservation types of projects in public buildings. The Department of Energy set this up because public buildings are one sector that is not well served by our existing energy programs through the Business Energy Tax Credit or the Residential Energy Tax Credit or the State Energy Loan Program. So it's meant to be complementary to the existing programs that we have. The Energy Efficiency and Conservation Block Grant Program, we just received announcement that we got this award a couple days ago, actually. And the state, throughout the state, cities, counties, and the state are receiving $33.5 million. Additionally, there's $1.175 million going to tribal governments. And out of that $33.5 million, Oregon, the state of Oregon, is receiving $9.6 million. Now, of that $9.6 million, at least 60% has to go to the cities and counties that were not eligible for the direct allocation. The largest cities and counties, the 10 largest cities and the 10 largest counties, received direct allocation of EECBG monies from the U.S. Department of Energy.
Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Question on the previous slide and on this one.
Sure.
When it said revolving loan fund, is that Oregon money that Oregon can loan out, or is that federal money that Oregon can borrow and pay back?
It's federal money that Oregon receives to capitalize its loan fund program so that we can loan it out. We do not have to pay it back to the federal government.
Very helpful. Second, and so I assume that's true of all of this also. This is money that could be spent, and well, let me ask, is this money that must be spent in grants, or could be spent to capitalize a loan fund, let's say, for efficient public buildings, for instance?
There's guidance set up by the U.S. Department of Energy for this state energy program and also for the Energy Efficiency and Conservation Block Grant Program. So there's eligible activities under each of those programs. Setting up a revolving loan fund is one of the eligible activities under the SEP program.
Thank you.
Okay. Moving on to the State Energy Efficiency Appliance Rebate Program, our Department of Energy is finalizing its application for this. They are putting together a program that will complement the Residential Energy Tax Credit Program along with the federal tax credits that are available for energy-efficient appliances, and we expect to receive $3.6 million in formula funds for that. Also, from the U.S. Department of Energy, the state has received $38.5 million from Weatherization Assistance Program. This is being administered through the Department of Housing and Community Services in conjunction with the community action programs. And basically, this money is meant to reduce energy costs for eligible low-income clients by making homes more energy efficient.
Question.
Sure.
Representative Smith.
Thanks. I'm curious about all this stuff. And is that money going to be run through the 2626 process? Is that specifically for home weatherization, and is it integrated with what we've already got going? And Jules, you probably already know the answer to this, but I don't.
Representative Smith, it will not be integrated with House Bill 2626. The state is working with some municipal partners to put together a competitive grant application for competitive money, also available through the Energy Efficiency and Conservation Black Grant Program, to expand on the concept of the program authorized by House Bill 2626.
I might have a follow-up, but thanks.
Go ahead.
Thank you. The Enhancing State Government Energy Assurance Capabilities and Planning for Smart Grid Resiliency, which does not have an acronym, thank goodness, but this is meant to improve the resiliency and critical energy infrastructure and to mitigate impacts and ensure that Oregon is prepared to respond and recover from a catastrophic event. This money is going to the Oregon Department of Energy. It's about $500,000. And finally, the PUC is receiving over $800,000 to the state Electricity Regulators Assistance Program. This is meant to provide capacity to the PUC to review the influx of projects that are expected through the Recovery Act. Additional formula funds coming into Oregon for natural resources projects include the state clean diesel program. This is $1.7 million, and this will help Oregon meet its clean diesel goal and also to reduce exposure to diesel emissions. The Oregon Business Development Department will be receiving $614,000 for their brownfields revolving loan fund, and this is to clean up contaminated sites so that they can be available for redevelopment. And also, the Oregon Department of Energy received $3.6 million. Oh, my goodness, that amount is wrong. I'm sorry. They received about $15,000, not $3.6 million, through the Aquaculture Assistance Grant through the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And this is to help aquaculture producers who were suffered from the high price of feed during 2008. So to talk a little bit about some of the non-formula monies coming to Oregon, the Oregon Department of Forestry is receiving, at this point, about $10.5 million from the U.S. Forest Service. And this is for hazardous fuels mitigation and reduction projects, forest health improvement projects, which includes some invasive species types of projects. There's also some invasive species control money that's come to the Oregon Department of Agriculture from the U.S. Corps of Engineers and from the U.S. Forest Service, and to the tune of almost $300,000. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife received a competitive grant from NOAA for the removal of derelict fishing gear for almost $700,000. And the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife also received some fish passage money from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for almost $200,000. And finally, the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps received $6.25 million from the U.S. Forest Service for Oregon Youth Initiative, and that employed at least 350 additional youth this summer through the OYCC programs.
And just to clarify, when you said these were non-formula dollars, that means these were won through a competitive process?
Yes, and the competitive processes vary. Like, for example, the NOAA grant, ODF&W had to actually complete, you know, there's an RFP that went out for, they had to complete an application. In other cases, like the Forest Service has done a review of a whole bunch of projects, sent it to D.C., and then they've come back with a list of the projects that D.C. wants them to fund. So, you know, how competitive it is, it varies. So just to give you an idea of where the money is going in Oregon, this is for the formula funds. And right now we've got 18 safe drinking water projects totaling, as I said, $28.5 million that have been approved. And this is expected to create over 500 positions over the next couple of years. We also have 13 wastewater and irrigation projects that totaling almost $45 million that have been approved. And they're expected all to support several hundred jobs over the next couple of years. As I mentioned, 300 youth were hired through the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps, and they did trail work, habitat restoration, invasive species removal types of projects this summer. There will be additional youth hired over the winter also, but not quite that many. 22 energy efficiency projects for K-12 schools totaling over $500,000 have been approved to receive state energy program funds. Those are primary lighting and heating types of projects, and it's expected over the next month additional SEP projects will be announced. And then over 200 municipal vehicles, including transit and school buses, will be retrofitted with verified exhaust emission control technologies through the state clean diesel program. And those projects are located in Lake Oswego, Lane in Washington counties, TriMet buses up in the Portland area, and also school buses in the Klamath and Beaverton school districts. And then there have been 5 water quality planning projects planned to support TMDL, total maximum daily load development and implementation, habitat restoration, and water quality improvements throughout the state. That's just an example. Those are not all of them. And then I also wanted to give you an idea of what type of money is coming into Oregon through the federal agencies for natural resources through the Recovery Act. The Corps of Engineers expects to receive approximately $190 million for the Portland District. This is for projects in Oregon, although some of them are in Oregon and Washington because we've got the Columbia.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative.
These are projects that are being run and managed by these agencies.
Yes.
And they're not related to the ones you've already described.
Representative Barnhart. Yes, you're correct.
Great, thank you.
Yes. U.S. Forest Service is receiving, in Oregon alone, over $137 million is coming for forest projects. And these projects are for on federal forest land, but also, as I mentioned, at least $10 million is going through the Oregon Department of Forestry, and they will be implementing projects on state and private forest lands in addition to some federal forest land projects. The Bureau of Land Management is receiving $40 million.
Representative Benz.
Forgive me for interrupting, but does the state of, aside from the $10 million, does the state of Oregon have anything additional to say or input into the expenditures that we see up there, the 190 and the 137, or the 40? Or is that a top-down thing driven by D.C.?
Representative Benz, my understanding from the agencies, for example, the Forest Service, looking at my list here, Bureau of Land Management, NRCS, when they were putting together a list of potential projects, they did consult with the state agencies. And so the state did have an opportunity to give them their ideas of which projects were really priority projects that really need to get funded. And so then, and it varies agency by agency, but in many cases, those lists were sent to D.C., and the headquarters, they went through and reviewed, and they decided how much Oregon was getting through the federal agencies.
So is that locked in now? That whatever those projects are, we must go ahead and do them. There's no flexibility.
Representative Benz, I'd have to check, especially with the Oregon Department of Forestry. I know they've been working very closely with the U.S. Forest Service, and so I'm not quite sure to what level of specificity the projects are locked in.
Thank you.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is receiving $5.5 million. The National Park Service, about $1 million. The U.S. Geological Survey, almost $500,000. The Natural Resources Conservation Service, about $3 million. And then there's several other USDA programs in the state that are also receiving money. So where is the federal money going? And these are just a couple examples. But, for example, that almost $5 million in Bureau of Reclamation money is going to the Deschutes Ecosystem Restoration Project and also to the Umatilla Project. They each got almost $500,000. I mean, not $500,000, $250,000. The NRCS money, about $3 million, is going to buy floodplain easements throughout the state. Much of the money is going for deferred maintenance on federal lands and at federal facilities. There's a lot of it is going for habitat restoration and fish passage types of projects. There's also money going towards renewable energy and energy efficiency retrofits, primarily on federal facilities. And then there's money going for road and trails. And then I want to give you a couple examples of some of the competitive Recovery Act monies that are coming into Oregon. Through the Diesel Emissions Diesel Emissions Reduction Act, EPA has a Smart Way Clean Diesel Finance Program. And an Oregon company, Cascade Sierra Solutions, which is located in Coburg, received $9 million of money through this competitive grant program to establish a lease-to-own program that will deploy new clean Smart Way certified trucks and install emissions reduction technologies, exhaust retrofits, aerodynamic trailers, and Smart Way verified tires for trucks. So this is a revolving loan program. So my understanding is the $9 million is meant to capitalize a program that should keep on going. And like I mentioned, it's for the installation and leasing of verified technologies. That last sentence, oh no, okay, my notes are wrong, excuse me. Then the Bureau of Reclamation has a challenge grant program, and they awarded two grants in Oregon. One was about $2 million to the Swale Irrigation District, and this is for some piping and small hydro work, and also $1.3 million to the Three Sisters Irrigation District, and this is for over 16,000 feet of piping to pipe an open canal, and also for installation of some remote monitoring and control systems, and also to market over 800 acre feet of water per year for increased flows for fish. And then the
US, and this is a project that falls within the Deschutes Basin that we just heard about.
Yes. And then the USDA has a woody biomass utilization fund, and there's about $250,000 that went to two projects in Oregon, one in the Wallawas and one in Lakeview. And then finally, Section 1603 is the grant in lieu of tax credit program, and this is an ongoing program, but about $141 million went to three wind farms so far in eastern Oregon.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The challenge grant, is that a 50-50 share?
I believe it is. I would have to look at the details.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
And finally, I just wanted to give you the websites where you can get information in the next couple weeks about where this money is going, jobs. We expect in Oregon that we will have data available on our website after October 12th. And the word from the federal government right now is they expect to have their website updated with data after October 15th.
Well, thanks. I'm sorry that we don't have more time to explore some of these lines, but I appreciate this overview. Very helpful. And we'll have a shorter amount of time, even shorter amount of time, I'm afraid, to spend on the little mini stimulus that this legislature passed early in the 2019 session.
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, I'm Chris Couts, and I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Department of Administrative Services. Thank you for having me here this morning. I'll talk a little bit about the state stimulus program as you requested. Late last year, legislative leadership approached the Legislative Fiscal Office and asked them to work with state agencies to identify projects that could get going within a 2 to 4 month window, mainly deferred maintenance projects. So these aren't meant to be investments for the long term, but to deal with deferred maintenance issues for state-owned buildings. So with that, through Senate Bill 338, which was passed in early February, there was $175 million that was made available to 12 state agencies, including community colleges and the universities, to support the state stimulus package. There's over 547 projects that were authorized at that time. So what happened from there was the procurement offices in those 12 state agencies had a lot of work to do in a short amount of time to get the projects out to the vendor and supplier communities. They worked with the Governor's Advocate for Minority Women and Emerging Small Business and went around and did 8 presentations to vendors and the supplier community within that by the end of March so that people knew what the money was for, what the projects were, and what they could bid on and how those processes were going to flow. By the end of May, most of the projects were up and running. There were some projects that were excluded because they didn't meet bond council requirements, and some projects were canceled by the agencies because once they got in, they found that structurally the project couldn't move forward. I'll give you an example. There was some large overhead doors that were going to be replaced at a maintenance shop. When they actually got in and brought the vendor out there, they were like, structurally, you're bent, you're crooked here, and we can't just install a door, it won't work, you're going to have to deal with the whole building's foundation. So that project was canceled by the agency because the money wasn't there to do the structural work in order to get the new doors in, for example. And there were only about 7 of those projects once they got in. So 547 projects authorized, there are now 490 active projects out there. So with that, 487 have actually been started to date. The report that I have handed out to you reflects the status of projects through August 31st and where we're at with those. So I'll just run through on the executive summary, really lays out in short form. We'll keep it.
Yeah, I don't think we'll have time to go past the executive summary.
No, and that's
but
fine.
But the report is very helpful. Appreciate
you
it.
Bet. So as I said, we have 487 projects started. Two of those weren't planned to start until October, and another one, they had to do some more structural engineering before they got started to make sure they could actually complete the project. It will get going here quickly. Of the 90 projects. 416 are planned to be ended by December 2009. And I think that's important because that reflects the short-term nature of a lot of these projects. These weren't big infrastructure investment projects. In some cases, they were, especially at the universities and at the community college level. There were some larger projects there, but a lot of these were smaller deferred maintenance types of projects. $51.7 million has been spent to date. 5,832 jobs in total have either been created or retained over the course of when the funding became available. 78% of those jobs have been filled by Oregon residents. That was some of the discussion that we had with the Ways and Means Committee when we put the information out there and the projects out there. 86% of the projects are using Oregon products, vendors and contractors. So another good statistic there. 9% of the projects have gone to minority women and emerging small businesses, those that are actually certified. And over the course of the life of the projects, it is expected that energy savings will be about $12 million. Those are for those projects that were identified for energy savings. Not all projects were.
Great. Thank you very much for your presentations. If there are any quick questions or comments.
We need to move along.
We do need to move along. I'm sorry that we don't have more time to spend on this topic. But thank you very much for your presentations. This is really valuable. Yes, Mr. Carrier, will you join us for a brief discussion? I think many, if not all, members of the committee have seen and heard about the governor's executive order earlier this month related to a reset cabinet and finding efficiencies in state government. We're interested in that, as well as the letter that the governor sent to legislative leadership earlier in the summer that recommended some of the suggested sort of places to look for those efficiencies. When the governor puts out a letter, we take it seriously. We're interested in hearing what sort of follow-up, if any, you expect we may have to do related to this, or you would like us to do related to the ideas for consolidation or elimination boards, commissions, several related to natural resource areas that this committee has worked with. I personally am interested in examining, certainly not for the short term, but examining over the long term ways in which we could do our work in the natural resources arena more efficiently as a state, particularly when it comes to administrative tasks. We have, 14 separate natural resource agencies, there are other states that have modeled ways of bringing together some of those, perhaps for better, perhaps for not, but you've had some hand in that, Mr. Carrier, elsewhere, and so interested both in the particulars of the governor's vision as well as the sort of bigger question of what legislators might be doing when it comes to finding efficiencies in the natural resource arena.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Mike Carrier, Governor Kulongoski's Natural Resources Policy Director. Thank you for inviting me here today. I have a goal of opening this discussion with you, which I hope will be an ongoing discussion. I'm glad to hear your reference to long-term, as well as to share with you some experiences I've had and the governor's vision and his feelings about how we reset Oregon state government, particularly with regard to the coordination of natural resource agencies. I'm going to talk to you this morning about three things. One is the personal experience I've had working in three states in natural resource agencies over the last 35 years. Now, some may say that I can't hold a job. I prefer to refer to myself as a state government dilettante. But I have had the opportunity to work in three states, two Midwestern states, and now gratefully in Oregon, in natural resource policy. And I actually went through a major reorganization of state government in Iowa 20 years ago that included a consolidation of several diverse agencies into a Department of Natural Resources. I want to talk to you, secondly, about where the discussion about natural resource agency coordination or consolidation stands with regard to the governor's recent executive order. And then finally, I want to talk to you about the role of the governor's Natural Resource Office and the relationship among the natural resource agencies in terms of how we coordinate policy and ensure that when agencies act, speak, or
otherwise deliver their services, that they're doing so with the maximum efficiency and speaking with one voice. Let me talk first then about the experience I had. I worked in Indiana where we had two cabinet, what I refer to as, and I'll refer to cabinet agencies as those that operate under a strong executive branch under the authority of the governor, usually directors appointed by the governor, or the board and commission style of government like we have here in Oregon, where you have a lot of statutorily independent and sometimes constitutionally independent agencies that operate under the authority of a board and commission. But in Indiana, we had two independent cabinet agencies, a DEQ and a DNR, and they were fairly isolated from each other, and the relationship was not particularly strong, especially in the areas where they were required to overlap. I worked in Iowa for 15 years and started out in what was then a conservation commission. Now, interestingly, Iowa's constitution and Oregon's constitution are very similar, and at one time, Iowa's state government structure was very, very similar to Oregon's, with a lot of commission and board-led agencies and a very, very weak executive authority on the part of the governor. In 86, there was a major reorganization of state government in Iowa, collapsing 66 agencies into 20 major cabinet departments, with each director appointed by the governor, subject to confirmation by the Senate. Likewise, we reduced the number of boards and commissions in that state from about 98 to about 22, which was a significant overhaul. I learned a lot from that experience. I was directly involved in forging the several agencies into a DNR, as well as continuing to work for a number of years after under the DNR structure. And then I've come to Oregon, where we have what I call the board and commission style, several statutorily independent agencies with a somewhat, at least in terms of the Constitution, weak executive authority on the part of the governor that's more ministerial rather than executive. Let me tell you about what I learned from reorganizing Iowa government, because I think it is instructive for any legislature, any governor, any state, as you think about resetting or reorganizing government. First, it requires political support, of course, from your stakeholders and customers of the agencies. Now, with regard to natural resources, I get this comment often from the governor and other policy staff is, come on, Carrier, the agencies that you have in your portfolio represent the very smallest piece of Oregon state government, and yet you generate the most controversy and you dominate our attention and time. Why is that? Well, it's the nature of the work that we do, particularly in a beautiful state like Oregon that's endowed with the resources we have. Along with that comes what I often refer to as an industrial strength suite of stakeholder and interest groups and participants with us in this dynamic process of managing and implementing natural resource policy. And it's, I think it's amplified here in Oregon that if we were to start a discussion about consolidation of natural resource agencies, we can expect a high level of interest and varying degrees of support or lack thereof from our stakeholders, our interest groups, and customers of those agencies. So you've got to have them in the dialogue, and you've got to have consensus among them. Secondly, the other thing that's absolutely essential is a willingness on the part of the legislature to consolidate authority under the executive branch, because that's what you end up doing. And I think, you know, knowing many legislators as I do, I think you're like me, you're somewhat schizophrenic about this. At times you'd like stronger central authority and better coordination, and other times you really enjoy and appreciate the way we do government here, because it is represents a broader involvement and more influence on part of the legislature and committees like yours on how agencies operate. The third is you, of course, need strong support from the governor. And along with that, I think you need a governor that understands the importance of deference to agency judgment and respect for agency expertise. Because if you just consolidate agencies into a cabinet-style government that's highly politicized, and I have worked in an environment like that, the consequences are even worse. And the last ingredient you need is really strong agency leadership going into a reorganization that fosters the right culture and the right identity for the agency. In my experience in Iowa, we had that with our natural resource agencies, very, very strong leadership who understood that you had to create a new culture and get everyone to become a part of that culture very quickly. Other agencies that were consolidated in that state, 20 years later, their divisions, which had been previously been separate agencies, continued to operate as if they had no association with their cohort divisions. So are there efficiencies that can be achieved by a discussion about consolidation of natural resource agencies? Yes, I think there can. I think foremost among them is in the area of policy coordination. Are there efficiencies that can be achieved in terms of agency financing? I think in the case of natural resource agencies, because we represent less than 1% of the total general fund, you're not going to find much money there. There can be some financial savings, particularly in the areas of agency administration, where you can consolidate administrative systems. But in terms of delivering the essential programs and implementing the natural resource policies of those agencies, you really don't save a lot of staff or money by co-locating them. But there, I don't want to underscore or underplay the fact that you can achieve some administrative efficiencies by consolidation.
Mr. Carey, I don't think you probably mean to suggest that because they're not general funded agencies, typically.
No, I don't mean
not worthwhile to try to reduce costs to fee payers or.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for asking for that clarification. No, I don't mean to infer that at all. I was thinking about general fund because that is principally on the resetting Oregon State Government executive order that the governor has issued. That's his principal focus, is general fund. And so if we talk about natural resource agency consolidation with regard to capturing more general fund savings, I'm saying, you know, you may put more effort into what you're going to gain out of that, but certainly with regard to all the other funds, because natural resource agencies, the lion's share of their financing is other fund, it's my opinion, looking at how those funds are applied and how prudent you are in exercising your authority over the agency's ability to charge those funds and recover agency's costs, I don't see much opportunity on the other fund side of this for significant savings.
Right, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good to see you, Mike. So are you suggesting that there wouldn't be a lot of savings because the overall amount of expenditure in our natural resources agencies is low, so even if we had found 5% efficiencies, that doesn't save a whole lot of money, general fund or otherwise? Or are you saying that there isn't even that significant percentage that can be saved? Because I could imagine setting aside whether we wanted to take some money from natural resources and spend it somewhere else or cut fees or whatever, would we be able to improve service delivery by 5% because we found efficiencies, right? Just imagining a static amount of money.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, thank you for that clarification. It's what I was inferring was the former.
Okay.
If you could perhaps save several million dollars.
Okay.
But relative to, you know, what you're going to be looking for in the next 2 years in terms of savings, that's a very small percentage as compared to some of the other efficiencies the governor is hoping to achieve with the resetting Oregon government executive order, which is the second thing I want to turn your attention to now. Now, let me precede that by talking about the June 8th letter. I've tried to, as best I can, ferret out where that list came from that was attached to the June 8th letter to leadership. And in talking with the folks at the Department of Budget and Management, which I think principally had input into the attachment to the letter, the references to, say, elimination of the Board of Geology or the Board of Geological Examiners, or moving the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries into OSU, and then at the very end, the very, very generalized concept of consider natural resource agency consolidation, and talking to the folks at Budget Management, what they did to put that letter together was go back through their archives about previous discussions in past years that even predate me, if you can imagine that, where those were issues that came up and were considered in past sessions. I think their need to get the letter out before you adjourned didn't really allow for a more thoughtful and comprehensive analysis of where are the opportunities today, so they went back and looked historically at what had been proposed before. If you look at the governor's executive order and his creation of a special cabinet, clearly all the emphasis is on the three areas of public safety, education, and human services. And in fact, there's no reference to natural resources, nor in the membership of the cabinet that he's created, is there any representation that would bring any expertise or perspective on this discussion about natural resources. Mr. Chair, that's why I appreciate you talking about starting this discussion, maybe even outside what the governor hopes to deliver to you in terms of a suite of recommendations by June 30th of 2010 under his executive order, that this is a discussion we ought to be having for the long term. The third thing I said I wanted to mention is how we coordinate among the natural resource agencies now. We have a body that's existed for, I think, the past three governors called the Natural Resource Cabinet. I call it my ad hoc Department of Natural Resources. We meet twice a month, usually for an hour and a half each meeting. And those meetings often include presentations regarding policy issues that span agency lines and agency jurisdiction and authority, and are followed with a discussion about how the agencies will need to coordinate and cooperate to ensure seamless service delivery and consistent policy application on those particular issues. It includes commitments from the directors in terms of follow-up. The cabinet, I would welcome any of you to join us for a cabinet meeting. I think you'll find it one of the most intellectually stimulating and inspiring groups of people to work with. When Governor Kulongoski was elected in 2002, shortly after his inauguration, he came to two cabinet natural resource cabinet meetings to deliver a message. And after I'm a little slow, it took me a while to get the message, but when I got the message, I really understood it. He was saying, look, I understand the structure of Oregon state government is such that many of you are hired or appointed by a board or a commission who I get to appoint, but nonetheless, you serve at their pleasure. I understand statutorily or constitutionally your agency may have quite a bit of independent authority from the executive office of the governor, but I'm here to tell you that you're all accountable to me. And he takes that issue very seriously because he feels accountable to you with regard to how agencies operate, particularly how the directors lead those agencies. And what I realized about that message is he was delivering a message of strong accountability that included a requirement for agencies to coordinate and cooperate with each other. Some of the examples of coordination work that our office leads are the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watershed. We have a number of teams that have been operating since the Kitzhaber days to implement the Oregon Plan, and our office continues to dedicate part of a staff person's time to provide that coordination among the agencies. Likewise, with recovery planning for our listed salmonid populations in various basins of the Northwest, that same staff person provides coordination and leadership among the state agencies because developing these recovery plans under the Endangered Species Act in cooperation with federal agencies requires a number of state natural resource agency effort. We work to coordinate those. We provide coordination of review and comment on a number of natural resource issues, significant natural resource issues, when those issues span agencies. Examples include liquefied natural gas terminal sightings. We provide coordination and ensure cooperation and consistency among the agencies on that issue. Natural gas pipelines. Major planning efforts like the Western Oregon plan revision for the ONC lands. Governor Kulongoski signed on as a cooperating agency, as did 10 state natural resource agencies signed on with the BLM as cooperators in the preparation of that plan, which required coordination as well as a final review of the plan. And that is an example where in some cases our office provides the direct leadership, in other cases we assign a lead agency. In the case of the Whopper planning, we assign the Department of Forestry to be the lead agency to work with us to coordinate other agencies' reviews and input.
Mike, we're going to have to finish up.
And I'm just wrapping up here. I want to just touch on the special issue of water policy that you mentioned to me before we scheduled this committee meeting. We now have at least eight agencies that deal with water in Oregon in some authoritative way. DEQ, WRD, DSL, Agriculture, Department of Forestry, Fish and Wildlife, DOGAMI, OPRD. I know there's special interest on the part of this committee in that particular subject and learning about each of those agencies' authorities, where they overlap and how they can be made more efficient. I want to encourage you to have that discussion with the agencies and to explore those issues with them. As you do, I think you'll identify opportunities where we could implement water policy, protect our resources, and deliver services to our citizens more efficiently. But also, as you talk to those agencies, I think you'll observe four things, especially as you talk to their executives. You'll hear and see solid expertise in their respective areas of responsibility. You'll see a passion for the work that they do. And you'll see a healthy relationship generally with their stakeholders and their customers. And finally, you'll see a professional collegiality and a sense of cooperation among those agencies that I think is emulated up and down, top to bottom, through their departments, across department lines. And that's what makes it so gratifying for me to be able to work with these natural resource agencies in the cabinet. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Mike. And, you know, I certainly hear your message about the long-run project that sort of create, if you will, possibly creating or consolidating agencies to create something more like a Department of Natural Resources would be. That is a long-term project. I don't underestimate the challenge of that, nor do I assume that that would be desirable, but I think it's something that some of us at least are interested in beginning to explore. I'm concerned, however, that we not defer on short-term steps, if there are any, that we could take to make the work of our natural resources agencies more efficient, whether that be efficient from a policy setting, more coordinated on a policy setting side, or realizing some of the administrative efficiencies that may be out there. So, you know, Representative Thompson and I sit on the healthcare committee. We heard yesterday about work that the reset cabinet may do related to related to healthcare commissions, which again, it's not going to realize millions of dollars of savings that we can put into schools, that these are entirely other funded agencies, yet there seems to be a willingness to say, yeah, let's take this on, and perhaps in 2011 we'll be looking at proposals for consolidation of some of those agencies. The fact that this is that in natural resources, this is really, really difficult. That the stakeholder politics are tough. That there's just so much, such a high level of engagement, and the stakes are high. Doesn't mean that I think we should say, well, it's a project for another day. So I recognize, and I don't mean to put the fear into agencies or suggest that they're there are people on this committee or elsewhere who are looking at lists and saying someone's on the chopping block. I just wonder how you get this conversation started, right? Because you've said, well, it's not really about the list. It's not about the letter that was sent. You've said it's a long-term project. I agree with those sentiments, but I think there's also an interest in getting this started and not just saying it's a project for another day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me respond to that very quickly because there's a fifth thing I should have mentioned. I think you'll hear from these directors as you talk to them about those very issues, real candor and a real openness to what are the short-term things that we could be doing or should have done already to deliver our services more efficiently or to even save money. And I'll just give you one example, and it's based upon it. And talking about this issue preceding this committee meeting with the directors, they mentioned water in particular and said, we have divided the application and administration of water policy with, Department of Agriculture having ag water policy, Department of Forestry having forest water policy, DEQ having general water quality. And much of that, by their own admission, was based upon the politics of the time. The assignment of the removal of fill permit authority to the Department of State Lands reportedly was a political decision because of dissatisfaction with a particular director at one time. So a lot of the past decisions that have been made were driven by, too often by, what was an ephemeral problem rather than what is the best long-term policy decision to make. And so I think you'll find with the directors that engage with you, and I'm very eager to engage with you on these conversations, a real candor about can we do business more efficiently. And I know you'll hear it from the stakeholders as well, particularly on the issue of water policy application.
Thanks. Thanks, Mike. Appreciate the candid conversation, and we'll be following up.
Thank you.
Thanks. Mr. Long and Ms. Shepherd, we're going to have a discussion of energy efficiency in state buildings, and we're beginning to fall behind our schedule, so we'll try to move along. I thought one way of dealing with the challenge of a four-hour committee meeting was to divide it into short chunks, try to keep the topics moving along pretty quickly. Another way is for members to get up and take a stretch, and certainly have no objections to that. We don't have a break built in, but I hope members will avail themselves as necessary.
All right, it looks like I'm up first.
You're up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ellen Shepard. I'm the Sustainability Coordinator for the Oregon Department of Administrative Services. Thanks so much for having me here today. In the interest of time, because I have been looking at the clock, I started my presentation with some background just about sustainability, about the sustainability program at the department. I think I'll go ahead and let you read that on your own. I'll be happy to answer questions if you have any later. And I'd like to start on slide 5 at the top of page 3, which gives a little background of the department's sustainability plan that we established just about a year and a half ago that hits on 7 of Governor Kulongoski's key sustainability goals. One of them, the second bullet, being energy savings in state buildings, the 20% by the year 2015 over the year 2000 baseline, which is in statute, and that's something that state agencies are working towards, including the department. On the next slide, it talks a little bit about some of the results we've had through the plan. Over the last year, we accomplished 54 of our action items, which is 80%. We gave ourselves a B- for our results. We're looking forward to raising that in the next year. On slide 7, you'll see we have some sustainability successes. We've had many, many, many. These are just some highlights. Some of them around energy have been green teams. We're looking at establishing tenant committees of green teams in our buildings, and we have very successful results to date of not only including the tenants in communications of what's happening, but actually involving them in the activities, in the operations and maintenance aspects, and policy enforcement. And we're finding really great results by having them on board and actively participating. We installed a chilled beam project in Eugene and the Eugene State Office Building. I won't go into the details of chilled beams. I'd be happy to answer that later, but it's a very innovative new kind of heating, ventilating, air conditioning system that goes into the building that allows for a cleaner, quieter, more efficient building. So far, the results have been very promising. That system's been in for about 6 months that the tenants have been occupied. We installed solar panels on our building in Pendleton, and so far that has brought some great results. We have been able to infuse the economy a little bit there. We involved a local contractor who's now been getting other jobs as a result. We have increased the alternative fleet vehicles, and we've established a sustainability fund that allows us to use the incentive money from previous projects towards new innovative sustainability projects. The Resource Conservation Management Program at the department began in 1996. That's when we began very actively tracking our utility bills, looking at anomalies, investigating them, and correcting them. The utilities we track in the buildings through this program are electricity, gas, water, sewer, garbage, and recycling, and those are all the ones that we're actively looking for efficiencies. When I came into the position in 2001 until 2004, I was actively tracking the savings. We were able to avoid about $2 million in utility costs over that four-year period. Some of the technologies we employ to make this program successful, we have a building automation system that allows us to track temperature, set points, program for vacation days, furlough days, those kinds of things. It's a very sophisticated system for the heating, ventilating, and air conditioning. We use eManager and Energy Expert through Portland General Electric to track our utility bills. Our electricity, it allows us to look the following day at what happened the previous day in a building so that we can actively investigate anything that looks out of whack. We monitor our bills through Utility Manager, which is a system that gives us reports. We input our bills every month, and it allows us to track. We run a bill audit, and then we can look for anomalies and efficiency opportunities. The energy conservation management policy, we've had a policy in place for about 5 years, and it was really pretty innovative when we first came out. These are things around building operation, building maintenance, tenant involvement. The new policy that came in place July 1st took that innovation even farther. We moved our custodians from nights to days, and that was so that we could save on the nighttime electricity load for lighting. We now perform quarterly night audits to look for opportunities where tenants might be leaving their computers, their task lights, those kinds of things on at night. We also listen for, or on those audits, they listen for HVAC that could potentially be operating when it shouldn't be. We've limited personal appliances, and we're really looking at IT equipment and how we can make that more efficient. Some of the results of our efforts have centered around electricity primarily right now. And here's an example of some graphs. This is the Energy Expert Program, and this is the kind of detail it allows us to get. This is the Labor and Industries Building. And before the policy took effect and we really focused so heavily on our nighttime use, the tenant use, you can see the base load, which is just the minimum amount that needs to run to maintain the building systems, was running at about 230 kilowatts. And after we got the tenants involved and started doing the night audits and really focused on their computers and task lights, we were able to drop that to 180 for a savings of about 50 kilowatts, which could equate to somewhere around $20,000 for a year.
It's hard to see on this slide, but that horizontal bar, horizontal line dropped.
Correct.
Reflecting the...
Correct.
The shape doesn't change much, but the whole thing is sunk.
Yes, correct. I was going to do a PowerPoint, but in the interest of time, decided to.
Thanks.
Overall, DAS is achieving a 26% energy savings over the year 2000. This is January through June of 2009. The savings represents electricity and natural gas, which is what we're required to track by statute.
And is this tracking all state buildings? When you talk about DAS, what universe of...
Mr. Chair, good question. It's the Department of Administrative Services buildings.
Okay.
So we have about 44 buildings scattered around. Many of the buildings on the Capitol Mall.
How many? I'm sorry.
44 buildings. We have about 3 million square feet of the state-owned space. We represent about 10%, roughly, of non-university system-owned buildings.
And did the goals that this meets, were they set for the state generally or just for DAS?
Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Long is going to be discussing
okay.
that further. It is a statewide goal for all state buildings.
Yeah, okay.
So just further results of the effort, these are the kinds of things we're able to see through the Energy Expert Program specifically as well. It might be a little hard to see in your handout there, but this is the employment building, and really what happens is the system ramps up in the first one, and then it just kind of goes back and forth, makes a little staggered start, kind of like a cartoon hair person. But in the after, you can see it comes up, and then it dips down, and then it goes up, and it's much smoother. So what that represents is energy savings as well as wear and tear on the equipment. And it was through this tool we were able to see the problem, identify it, and correct it. So some of our future plans, we're going to be looking at ways to increase tenant communication even further because we're seeing such great results by making sure that other folks in the buildings know what we're doing and have a role in it. We're going to be doing what we call scorecards, which is a way of just communicating the building status, the energy savings to date with the tenants. We're going to be putting in, we're investigating these smart power strips, which are basically power strips. Here's a picture, and they control the lights, the monitors, radios, things that might be at the desk based on an occupancy sensor. So the things turn off when people aren't there. They turn on when they are. And that would get at folks that are having trouble remembering to do it on their own. We're also looking at PC power management, which allows us to install a device on the server, and it turns off computers based on a user profile. I was asked to talk a little bit about the University Systems Program as well, since they're sort of the other big piece that's not represented. And they're very actively engaged in greenhouse gas reduction strategies as well as energy conservation. And you have the slides here in front of you. They're taking a leadership role both around research and development, which they can do so well at the universities, as well as working with their staff to try to reduce, and students to reduce what they can in the dorms and the offices. They have reduced their greenhouse gas consumption, as you can see in slide number 16. They're using the Clean Air, Cool Planet strategy, which is just one protocol of ways to measure greenhouse gas consumption. And they're looking at a per-student ratio for greenhouse gas. They felt that was the most accurate that would allow them to flex with increases or decreases in student population. And then they've put in place a climate action plan geared around energy efficiency and renewable energy. They're very well positioned to do quite a bit around renewables, and I do know at their Oregon Institute of Technology campus down in Klamath Falls, they're tapping into the geothermal resource and looking to have the first carbon neutral campus potentially in the world, definitely in the country. So just to end, thank you so much for having me. State buildings are particularly DAS buildings, are working hard to save energy and implement sustainability activities. And I'm open to any questions.
Let's move on to Mark, and maybe you can fill in. I mean, a couple of things that come to my mind based on that presentation is DAS is doing great. We've got good data here. I wonder about the other 90%. And the focus seemed to be on reducing energy use through changing kind of behaviors in the building, changing technology. I wonder about the building shell as well, because we know so much of energy loss is through efficient buildings themselves.
So I'll go ahead and get started, if that's
yeah,
all right.
Please do.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mark Long, Director of Department of Energy. I think there's kind of three things you should be familiar with on a policy side related to the kind of public buildings, and it applies to commercial buildings in some sense as well. But as you know, we have the 20% reduction for energy use by 2015, and that applies to the DAS buildings that Alan's working with, as well as other state buildings. And we work through a program with the state agencies to try to help them get to that target level. There's another component where if you design or build a major renovation or build a new state building, you have to exceed minimum building code by 20%. So you have 20% reduction in energy use by 2015, but if you go to build something, we want you to exceed code by 20% currently. And then there's another component that kind of overlays this. When you passed Senate Bill 79 this last session, all commercial buildings will be upgraded 15% to 25%, and I think building codes, where, you know, I came from, they're looking at about 20%, so there's a lot of 20% here. For all buildings, which includes public as well as commercial buildings, to exceed current code level 20% in April 1st of 2010. So lots of things going on to kind of get at the shell component that you're talking about related to whether it's a public building or a commercial building. The question is, you know, what level of required retrofit and what level of new constructions going on out there right now. So with that, you know, we have a program, we have the several programs that in our department, whether it's dealing with schools to try to help them achieve these certain goals, as well as the state buildings. I know you also, there were some questions around ERA and some of the other things, and it ties into commercial buildings, so I'd like to kind of just put a sharper point on that if you don't mind. A couple things around what we're doing, just to give you a little bit of background. I think the ERA team provided you an update. The SEP program, which is the State Energy Plan, which is the $42 million that we received through the U.S. Department of Energy, has now been fully awarded to the state. We have that broken up into two components. One is a public building component, where it's all buildings, again, not just state facilities, but local government, schools, colleges, state facilities. We received 1,100 applications for the first round of $17 million. By the time we went through kind of a vetting process, it got down to 350, and I have about 180 projects that we're going to be rolling out over the course of the next several months. We did our first announcement, as indicated, with some schools down in the Eugene-Springfield area last week. It was on Tuesday. I'll be out in Eastern Oregon tomorrow announcing another round of projects related to public buildings. We'll have another round in 2 weeks, another round 2 weeks thereafter, another round 2 weeks after that. And you ask why we're doing that? It has to do with the complexity of the project and the amount of money. And we're getting the easy stuff, things that are ready to go, instant job creation in the local community, what the impact to the community is, out the door as quickly as possible, and then the more complicated ones taking a little bit more time with. A couple other things around public buildings. The reason why this is important, because the things that we're doing with ERA and aligning it with some of the Betsy programs that we have, as well as some of the mandates, kind of all help us increase our building stock out there and provide for energy savings, and we think that's very important. And there is a tremendous amount of need and a tremendous amount of opportunity out there. The thing that we have to plan for, and we haven't yet, is what happens when this one-time ERA money is gone. You know, what's the mechanism next time around to help support these efforts? One last thing, just kind of to give you a sense of scale. For commercial buildings, we have projects as little as $5,000 in request for ERA funds and up to $1 million. That's the cap that USDOE allows for any one individual project. Again, there's 180 of them out there, and we're rolling them out in about 20 or 30 groupings at a time, because you got to make sure that they've got an energy audit ready to go. They have to meet certain performance standards for energy savings, as well as the contractor standards. And just something that you should be aware of, there's 87, I believe, data points that we have to report to the U.S. Department of Energy about the contract and about the project itself. So a lot of project management needs to occur. They got to be quality projects, they got to meet standards, and they need to be ready to go. And we're working on geographic distribution as well as a portfolio distribution, because we have to, again, for every $1,000 we spend, we have to achieve a certain level of energy savings. So I know you're wanting to kind of make up for time, and I'll be happy to
go
wherever you want.
Let's see if there are any questions. Yeah, I'm spend a couple of minutes on that and then move along. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With relationship to your rhetorical question of what do we do when it's gone, right? Two questions. First, how much do we anticipate spending? You know, sort of what's our rate of spending? When do we think we're going to run out? Okay, of the current money. And, well, actually, why don't we take them in turn? That's my first one. I got a second one.
So I'm going to have to run down.
I'll just go ahead and write that first one. All right. So, Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, we have to have the dollars expended. I can't remember if it's by 012 or 013. So,
okay.
The ERA money. And I can get you the exact answer. I can't remember off the top of my head.
Great.
And thanks. And in terms of the public building dollars, are we giving those primarily in grants or primarily by way of a revolving loan fund, and so that it could be sort of a gift that keeps on giving? It could be a portion of the answer of what happens when it runs out.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, the revolving loan fund component, something you need to understand about the SEP program. The program is has opportunity that's this large. The program that the State Department of Energy around public buildings was this kind of component, if you will. And we put in an application that represented what we had historically done in the area of commercial building upgrades and kind of aligning it with some of the existing programs we have, which did not include, the reason I'm bringing this up, revolving loan funds. So the first $17 million that I have, again, the 180 projects that we're rolling out, is funded through the ERA money. There's some Betsy money that folks are leveraging. Sometimes there's local block grant money, because again, communities can get their own ERA dollars and folks line those up. Sometimes it's a combination of a loan through our small energy loan program to help meet the project. Most of the things that I've put out the door so far are just straightforward SEP federal funded projects. One time, go and replace all the lighting in a school, go and replace all the windows, do a exterior building envelope retrofit, those kinds of things. When you get up into the larger projects, it takes kind of a blending and a leveraging of the funds in order to make that work. But the revolving loan component has not been one of the pieces yet with the SEP.
So I know we're short on time, but I want to say to all of us that I think we should seriously consider how that might work, and I want to learn more, and sure. Hope you will help teach me more about how that might work. And are there, it only works revolving loan fund, or it only works if people want to borrow the money and will be able to pay it back? But my under-informed understanding is that there are, for instance, school districts who wouldn't have access to cheap loan dollars that we could provide, and then we could allow, we'd be able to 10 years from now do it for another school rather than only be able to do that for the next couple of years. So I'd really hope that we'll prioritize that, and I'd like to be engaged in that conversation. Would welcome any advice.
Sure. I think if there's a walk away from this, from our presentation, at least on the funding side for me, is what I tell you today will be different next week. Okay. And here's why. The federal funding guidelines and the amount of program information that's coming out, it changes all the time. And so what I'm telling you is, here's what we have for today in this pot of money, and here's kind of what's going out the door. There'll be other opportunities to look at these kind of creative, innovative, how do you address the long-term component that we're working on. And then we just received announcement that the block grant dollars, and I think that was talked about, our share just came out this week. That's $9.6 million. 60% of that will go out to the what's called the non-eligible cities and counties, under 200,000 in population, and counties under 35,000 in cities. And we can do some things in those areas as well, and that whole application process hasn't started as well. So I guess I just want to make sure that you understand that the information and the opportunity is huge, the need is huge, and we are working through our first goal is to get the easy things, the projects that are ready to go, out the door quickly, because folks are you know where we're at from an employment standpoint, what the opportunity is, and then we're going to work on the creative pieces, and I'd love to follow up with anybody who's interested in that to work on that kind of next round of what's the future. Does that help?
It does. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That answered a lot of my questions, but just to follow up on a couple of points that you made, could you describe then, given the plan that the state put forward for the SEP money, could you describe where your department is in terms of communication on whether or not that's still the plan, how that could be changed in the future, and, as you say, the continuing new information that's coming forward?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, I'm sure Mr. Bailey wasn't looking for a plug on this, but I do need to credit Representative Bailey. He last month brought folks out from USDOE to look at some of the innovative programs that we worked on in the East, which we haven't touched on, and I found out that we have the ability to modify our plan that went in back in May that kind of narrowed down what our opportunities were, and so we're working on that department, and I expect to have request into USDOE within the next 2 weeks to look at things like revolving loans, to look at things like other market sector opportunities in addition to the public buildings. Okay, and I just kind of need to leave it at that broad level. I don't want to get out in front of the folks at USDOE. So thank you very much for what you did earlier, because it was very illuminating to find out how much flexibility, you get a set of standards and it says this, this, and this, and you're not aware that there's other flexible opportunities and innovative approaches you can take as an organization. We're moving on that, and it's a credit to Representative Bailey and others who have been engaged in these issues for some time.
Continuing the theme of a team effort here, are there key barriers that you are running into in getting these dollars out the door for the schools project? Are there ways that the state can facilitate, or are these federal barriers? How's that process going?
Mr. Chair, there absolutely were. One of the things that was surprising to me, and I think most of you know that I came in the job here recently, is when the award came out on June 26th for the first $17 million, I thought, hey, let's get the schools out by July 10th. It's under $50,000 out of a $42 million, under $50,000 projects, $500,000 out of a $42 million effort. Let's roll those out while the schools can get that work done. What we found was that each individual project had to be reviewed separately by the U.S. Department of Energy, and I got in line with everybody else across the country to find out whether $5,000 should be spent in a particular school and $15,000 here and there. We spent, and I got to give credit to the staff over there, spent the last 2 months getting those additional review requirements relieved by USDOE, and just in the last 2 weeks, we've gotten a free ride to start now moving out the projects, and that's why you saw last week the roughly 25 school projects that got out the door, and you're going to see about 20 tomorrow that are out the door, and you're going to see about 30 in 2 weeks, and that's about all I can manage at my end, because we've got to call each one. I won't give you an excuse. We've got to call each one, manage each one, develop a contract, make sure it meets the standards, get everybody going, give them the check, and make sure that they're okay with the reporting standards, and move on. So, thank you.
Final thought, Mr. Oh. Editorial comment. It sounds like the criteria that Mr. Long is putting forward and how the state is looking at using these dollars is that we are looking to use one-time dollars to catalyze a process that will have ongoing benefit and that will leverage structural and financial state resources to be able to have a continuing benefit from an investment that is being made. And I think that's exactly the approach that we need to be taking.
Much better said. Thank you.
Representative Boone.
Thanks. Mark, I was going to ask you, are you working with Dogami on their and OEM on their seismic safety upgrades on public buildings at the same time? Does that fit?
Chairman Boone, not that I'm aware of. So I'll take a look at it. We do have one of the pieces, I believe, that was shared. We have a $540,000 energy assurance study that deals with kind of what are the upgrade needs and those kind of things that we're working with the Public Utilities Commission and Dogami and others on. So I know there is some communication, but I'm not aware if there's any direct on their upgrade piece, but I'll be happy to follow up. Okay.
Thanks. Ellen, we're going to excuse you and move into the next topic.
Thank you.
Invite Mr. Meyer and Mr. Drummer up to join Mr. Long in discussion of the renewable portfolio standard that legislature passed in 2007. We had several bills related to it in 2009. Some passed, some did not. One passed and was vetoed. We'll see where we stand in terms of meeting these goals and what may be on the horizon from the executive perspective. So, Evo, you want to kick us off? How are we proceeding?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Evo Tremor, Energy Policy Advisor to the Governor. I'm here to give a brief update on House Bill 2940. As you might recall, 2940, among other Evo? Things, was going to bring in...
The microphone... Well, can you use Mark's microphone?
Was going to bring in about nine pre-95 biomass facilities into the RPS. These facilities were constructed before 95, which is the cutoff date, the original cutoff date in the RPS bill. One of the these facilities are older. One of them is as old as, I believe, 1936. The governor always felt strongly during the session and then in his veto that if you bring additional resources into the RPS, that you should adjust the RPS and keep the original goal of roughly 1,800 average megawatts that represents the 25% by 2025 whole and build on to that once you bring in additional resources. When the governor vetoed that bill, he made a commitment that he would want to talk to the forest industry about how to bring these facilities into the RPS. The governor's office, we're in the process of, we actually already scheduled a meeting for early November to bring stakeholders to a table, it's a larger group, to see if a compromise can be worked out, and we are hopeful that we can.
Thanks. Thanks, Eva. Want to talk 3039?
Want to do both of them?
Sure, go for it.
Only because that's the way my slide presentation is. Mr. Chair, members, good morning. For the record, I'm Lee Beyer, Chairman of the Oregon Public Utility Commission, and I'm here today to talk to you and bring you up to date on two bills that you have passed and we're in the process of implementing. One of them, I think three of you were involved in 2007 in passing Senate Bill 838, which established the state's renewable portfolio standard. And, of course, in the last session, you passed House Bill 3039. So we'll show you where we're at. The good news is that we are The two utilities that are affected by this, Portland General Electric and Pacific Core, are right on target of meeting those. The graph that's up on the screen there, if you look at that, the blue and the red pieces together represent either the blue is the facilities that are currently in place, and the red is that which will be in place. It's already in constructing the building. And you'll see that the green is what's called bankable RECs, and that was included in the regulation, and that's essentially any renewable generation that was generated prior to the date when the first standard was set in place, which is 2011, can be used to meet the requirements on a going forward basis. So essentially what you see represented there, there's going to be enough for PGE to pretty much, if they use all of those RECs to meet the standard without doing anything extra, clear up to 2025. Now, I should say without doing anything extra, that what I'm including in that is the fact that they're completing building now the Bigelow Canyon wind farm, which they own, that's about the size of a very large combined cycle gas plant. So it's over will be over 400 megawatts in terms of nameplate capacity. That's not to say that they're not adding more. In fact, they're doing RFPs and looking at additional facilities. Wind is pretty much in the market right now. So they're pretty much on target. Likewise, Pacific Core is pretty much on target as well. And one of the things I should point out to you is on the far end, you'll see some notes that says without RECs. One of the complex issues for us in dealing with Pacific Core is that they're a six-state utility. So in some ways, when Oregon established their RPS, they sort of established a backdoor RPS for Utah and Wyoming and Idaho, because we look at it as an integrated system, and we attribute 30% of the generation from any facility in Pacific Coast territory towards meeting Oregon's load. So in essence, for each megawatt of renewables that they build or to serve Oregon's load, they add two on the others. Now, so far, the other states haven't contested that, and that's largely because, to date, wind is coming on board at market prices. It's about the same as the gas generation. It's probably a little different now because gas has dipped, as you probably are well aware of. So those are the issues, but it gets tough. Let me jump two slides here. I want to show you. As I said, all of PGE's facilities are pretty much up on the Columbia River. That's their biggest plant. Pacific Core is a little different than if you look at the map. The big circles are the ones that are owned by Pacific Core themselves. The list of smaller ones there are power purchase contracts that are owned by somebody else, but Pacific Core has signed a longer-term contract to get them. Now, obvious one of the problems when you look at that, and as we develop the wind system, the real issue is transmission. To fully meet our RPS and, frankly, the other states' RPS around us, we will not have adequate transmission to do all of that. So in the years ahead, you're going to hear a lot about added transmission. I think during the last session, I know Representative Betts heard a lot about that, because I think one of the proposed lines went right through his property in eastern Oregon. But that'll be an increasing issue as we deal with that. So I think that's a lot of good news, and let me slide back. One of the things I wanted to point out was the relationship of mixing wind and other renewables in the system. And I thought this would be of interest to you. This is just a 5-day or maybe 6-day snapshot on the Bonneville system. So it's the whole Northwest. It speaks to their transmission system. The red bar on this, or red line, represents the load on a daily basis. In fact, it's on an hourly basis across the transmission system. The blue line below represents the wind portion of that. And one of the interesting things you'll see is I know in your households, when you flip the switch, you like to have the lights to come on. One of the issues when you're dealing with renewables is wind doesn't blow all the time. And so you have to have a system that's backed up to meet that. You call the integrator, and you hear operators talk about balancing the system. That's keeping the system in play all the time. If you look at the first day on that chart there, you'll notice that normal day for a utility is that there's virtually no use early in the morning, then it picks up and it peaks about 6, 7 o'clock at night, and then it drops off. You'll notice the wind chart that down there doesn't do exactly the same thing. It comes on a little slower traditionally, and then it's at its highest peak tends to be at nighttime. So you have a little bit of a mismatch there, and for an operator, they're ramping up other generators, preferably hydro, because that's the easiest, but gas, and then they're putting it down. But then you have some other things that happen, and that is represented by, if you look at where it says September 18th and 19th, some days the wind doesn't blow at all. And so you have to have a system that's big enough in terms of total capacity that you can still generate the electricity on those days as well. So that's a balancing trick that's out there, and it's new to the industry, and they're learning to deal with that. It's obviously easier when we're at the lower penetration levels, and it gets harder the more you have in the system. It just means you have to have that much more backup capacity behind to deal with that. And it's a cost factor, and I'll give you, just throw it out, it's Bigelow Canyon's total cost, what we'll be putting in the rates for that one, when it is fully developed, that'll be another $1 billion of costs that are put into the system. Now, to put that in context, we would have to build generation anyway, so you would still have costs around that too. The next slide is just a little different. In this one, the red line is what the generators forecast to the transmission operator, in this case Bonneville, say, this is how much generation we're going to put on your system and we're reserving this capacity. The blue line is what they put onto the system. So, again, it's a balancing issue. It's for the operator. They're having to, if there's too much electricity on the system, they're having to call somebody and say, ramp your generator down. And if there's not enough, if the wind is underperforming, they have to call them and say, I need you to ramp that up. And so there's some financial. So that's essentially the story on that. I think it's a good story. I think we're finding it works. Now, the nuts and bolts of this is the other feature of 838 is a requirement that the first compliance period is 2011, but the other requirement that the law puts into place is the utilities have to turn in compliance plans, and there are essentially 5-year plans, and then they have to do a compliance report annually once the first plan is put in. The first one will be filed in 2010. And it'll cover the period through 2015, and the next one will cover the period 2013 through 17. So we've got a target. We will know exactly what the utility strategies are, and we'll have some assurance that they will be indeed, they'll meet the plans. If there are no questions on that, I'm going to shift very quickly to 3039.
Yeah, and actually, let's pause here, and perhaps in the interest of time, hold off on the 3039 presentation if you're okay with that. I did not realize that would be part of your agenda. I'm interested in hearing it. We have the slides. Maybe we'll have a couple of minutes to get to it, but I want to see if there are any questions on the sort of underlying renewables policy. Representative Boone.
This is probably a really dumb question, but I also have another meeting set up with somebody to answer it, and they keep referring to it as it's magic. So how do they do it? Is somebody sitting there at some big switchboard and the wind shuts down and they push this button and that brings up the wave energy or what? How does it work? To keep it so that when you turn on the lights.
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, there actually is, they're called system control operators, and it's usually at the generation level in the Northwest. It's predominantly Bonneville, and they have they literally have automatic adjustments, and they can make the phone call and say, you need to ramp up or you need to ramp down. It happens. That's been happening for 100 years. Mm-hmm. Wind is just a little unique in terms of it's a little more variable. It's a little easier to predict what a gas generator or a coal plant or something else is going to do, but they fall offline too. I mean, so these are protocols that have been in place for a long time. Wind, there's a lot of learning. I think a couple of years ago when the wind first came on, there was a time when Bonneville, they were spilling a lot of water to meet the salmon needs, and they got to a point where they couldn't spill any more water. They had to run it through the generators, or they would over-oxygenate the water and kill fish. Didn't want that to happen. They also had too much wind, so they actually had to call the wind operators and say, feather your blades, quit generating as much. And in that instance, the first instance, they discovered that for about half of them, they didn't have their phone numbers. And in some of them, there was no one there to do that. But those problems have now been fixed, and that's just part of the learning experience of some very sophisticated engineers who are making this work. I mean, I guess one of my messages is I know many of you are very anxious as policymakers to run this really fast. You got to give the engineers and the professionals time to get there. They're committed to get there, but there's a lot of learning that they need to do to make it happen.
Yeah, just a quick follow-up. I took the tour of Bonneville, and there were real people there, and they were doing things and calling people. And it must be, so it's still human-driven a little bit.
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, I have to tell you that the people don't appreciate how sophisticated of a machine the transmission system is. It connects all 11 western states, the state of Baja, Mexico, and Alberta and British Columbia. And that system operates within a tolerance of 4 megahertz. Oh, if it doesn't, it falls apart. You don't want that to happen.
Representative Burnett. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lee, I'd like to look ahead a little bit at the mix. We're working hard, I know, on solar. Oregon State and others are working on wave energy. In Representative Bent's district, we're talking about adding, and in other places, we're talking about adding geothermal. What do the smart people think about this issue that we're discussing now, the availability of power and what amounts to base load and base capacity when you mix other sources? And the thing I see here when I look at this variable chart is that the wind seems to die off during the day. My layman's understanding is that solar is available during the day and not at night, and that might even out some of these fluctuations in the renewable energy availability. What do the people who are looking at the crystal ball tell you about this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, what people are hoping, as much as you've discussed, is that solar will have a place in there, and we'll balance that out a little bit. Solar has even more fluctuation than wind does when the clouds go over. There are some things that are coming along in technology that may make that work both for wind and solar in terms of storage. Mm-hmm. To the extent you have battery storage or you have there are other things, compressed air, hydro, you'll be able to balance that out a little bit. So, I mean, that's helpful. Geothermal, and from a utility perspective, I think most people would love to have all they can get because geothermal looks just like a gas plant or a coal plant. It's a great resource. The problem is there hasn't been a lot of it that has been found, and some of that's a cost issue. It should say, the engineers would say, all of this stuff could be available at the right price. It's just, are you willing to pay 50 cents a kilowatt hour? You know, when most of your constituents, representative, are paying about a nickel a kilowatt hour. So it gets a little tough to match that up. But I think we'll get to a lot of that. People believe they can make it. Frankly, another one is that the industry leaders believe that with coal plants, that by 2025, summer 2020-2025, that they will commercially be able to capture the carbon coming off of that and sequester it or use it for other sources. The biggest unknown about that, or the biggest question mark in industry mind, is will the laws allow them to sequester it? And that's largely a tort liability issue in terms of if I put it in the ground and somehow it comes back out, who's liable? And that'll probably take federal legislation to make that work. But I think longer term, people in the industry think they'll be able to get there. It will be more expensive. But you'll be able to get there. It is probably about a 10 to 15 year window to sort of making that happen. In the interim, natural gas generation is the assumed transition generation fuel.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions. First, and I'll put them all in one. The additional cost for transmission and for backup generation for the renewables. Maybe you could give us an idea of that. And also, do you have when I say additional cost per kilowatt hour for customers across Oregon, the second part of this question is how much of an investment has the federal government and the state of Oregon made in these new systems?
In the form of tax credits.
Oh. Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, the additional costs...
yes, my question.
Transmission has been traditionally less than 10% of the retail cost of delivery. And it's because it's spread across a big number. The kinds of investments we're talking about to build the Western transmission system are literally in the billions of dollars to do that. And they'll have an impact. I'm not sure. I can't give you a number of what it'll do. I don't think it is probably a huge rate impact itself. I think the generation side is probably more there. The tax investment, I don't know. I'm going to have to let Mr. Long address that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, on the transmission side, I'm not sure what it is there, and I think as a member of the Revenue Committee, you know, our you're looking at for 09-11, $167-168 million of tax investment in renewables. If you break that down, I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, about half of it is in the renewables and half of it's in the conservation, but I could be wrong, and I can get you the information, and we work very closely with LRO, and we've done the presentation, so...
What I really would like to be able to take back to the district is a statement that goes like this. Here's how much more your electricity is costing you because of the renewable aspect of the RPS. This is this is how much more as compared to, let's say, gas. So that we can say, okay, it would have been a nickel if we'd used all gas, but instead it's going to be 7 cents because we have wind and geothermal. And do we have that number yet?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, no, and I would have to say today with what Pacific Core has put online, which would be more in your territory, the wind is actually coming in at the cost of gas right now. Now, that's with the tax credit.
Can I, Representative Benz, if I may point out, in the long run, if carbon pricing is going to come either on a federal or regional level, the renewables will be a lot cheaper than coal or others. So I think in the long run, you'll see it actually cost savings because they just have no emissions associated with them.
You're with your indulgence.
Representative Benz.
It happened that I attended a meeting in Spokane and listened to discussions a couple of weeks ago on the River Governance Task Force or Commission. And one of the issues was the additional cost to Oregonians as a result of the demand of power to California. Do you think that California is having any impact on our overall rates as California asks for, let's say, the wind power that comes from Oregon systems?
Mr. Chair, I'll try that unless you want to jump in. Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, it'd be hard to put a number on it, but I will tell you that if you look at the wind development along the gorge, most of that wind is independent, and it's being sold to utilities that are not serving the state of Oregon. If you look at geothermal, it hasn't happened yet, but the largest geothermal project that's been talked about for years is over in the crater over in Bend, and that project, if it happens, is sold to California Pacific Gas and Electric Company. So when their governor and their legislature set a 33% renewable goal, in order to meet that in California, they're going to have to reach out and get stuff from everywhere. So that, by virtue of that, just pure economics, my assumption, haven't seen it yet, but my assumption is they're going to push the prices up. Now, the other side of that that may work to our advantage that we've been speculating on is that they're on the verge of allowing what's called purchase of unbundled renewable certificates to get that. Some of the projects that they're building in Oregon, currently there isn't transmission to send it to California. So what they may in effect do is just buy or take the RECs and allow the energy to be sold on the wholesale market, which probably would have the effect of driving energy prices down in the Northwest.
I was struck by the compliance charts of the RPS, and the Pacific Core and PG are not just meeting these targets, they have at least the potential to blow past these targets. And if you could sort of help us understand why a
policy that was so controversial in 2007. The 25% by 2025, but I think the first target, the 2011 target, is at 10% in 2011, that it looks like each utility could not only meet, but could, if they were to use these, particularly use these bank recs, would vastly exceed. So what's happened here? Because it would appear, and again, I know it's a complicated subject, but it would appear that we could have set this at 25% by 2010 and they'd still meet it, given the existing landscape. So, and costs.
Well, Mr. Chair, I could say it's just the utilities following the enlightened leadership of the legislature.
You could say that.
I think there is some of that.
None of us here believe that.
I think what you're seeing the effect of is that as these RPSs, not just in Oregon, but across the land, have been set, there's been more work in the area, and frankly, people are rushing to get the good sites, those with the higher capacity factors, and when you're building generation, it's better to, the norm is to build big rather than small, so there's a technical term in the utility industry, they're called lumpy resources. You tend to, when you build something, you have a need, but you build more than you immediately need. And I think we're seeing some of that. But I think a lot of it is just, and as I said, they're coming in comparable to where gas prices were a year ago and before. I mean, if you take me back to July of the prior year, we were looking at gas forecasts that said gas was going to cost $12 to $14 a unit. Well, today it's selling for under $3. So it's just a different marketplace. It's very competitive when you start looking at that high price. And I believe, and I think most people believe, that gas prices are going to go up again. Probably not to $13-$14, but they're probably going to settle in at the $8 range, give or take a dollar. And so with the tax credits and all that, wind is still a very reliable resource, or cost-effective resource at that level.
Thanks very much. It's been an interesting discussion. I look forward to continuing to follow up with you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks. We are going to conclude with a session on toxics policy. And could we have, do we have the director? Is Mr. Peterson here? So, Director Peterson, along with Kevin Masterson, Palmer Mason, and Gail Shibley, we can have you all at once, I think. That seems to work. And let me just introduce this topic before we hear from our panel by saying that this committee had some experience with toxics issues during the regular session, during the 2009 session. One of my, I don't want to say frustrations, but certainly one of my questions had to do with our broader vision as a state with respect to toxics. We dealt with a bill that addressed a single particular toxic, and I think it raised, at least for me, the question of, well, do we continue to take this toxic-by-toxic approach? I'm thinking both of air and water and land-related toxics, or do we, as a state, develop, or are we in the process of developing a broader strategy to address them, and would that be more appropriate than this toxic-by-toxic ban or system of regulation? So I asked Department of Human Services and DEQ to give us an update on the work that they have done and are doing in this area to prepare kind of next steps on toxics policy. I don't anticipate that this would necessarily lend itself to 2010 legislation, but be very interested in what we may be looking at in 2011. Director Peterson.
Yes. Chair Cannon, members of the committee, my name is Dick Peterson. I'm the director of Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality, and we are very pleased to be here and express appreciation for your and this committee's interest in toxics reduction strategy, as you described. We're here today to share what we're doing within DEQ in coordination with other state agencies on that matter. As you alluded to, Certainly, statewide data shows that toxic chemicals are widespread in Oregon's air and water and not necessarily linked to a particular program, if you will. So our intent here is to share with how we're looking at this holistically and some of the strategies that we're putting in place. We have and will continue to engage stakeholders that are impacted by toxics and by toxics decisions in terms of managing toxics. And our interest certainly is integrating all toxics reduction efforts to not only have a unified approach, but also to achieve what I think all of us are interested in, is reducing exposure to toxic chemicals that are of greatest concern to health and the environment. So going into that, we will and do intend to work with stakeholders to come up with cost-effective strategies to reduce risks from such chemicals. Today, I have two of my staff here with me, Kevin Masterson and Palmer Mason, who are going to describe our approach to a toxics reduction strategy in greater detail, and I believe we'll shed more light on some of the questions that you have relative to how we're approaching this. Again, I'm very appreciative and glad to be here today, and I'm glad you teed this up for discussion for the committee. I'm going to apologize a little bit ahead of time. I may be called next door. We have an item before the Ways and Means Committee coming up, but I'm going to stick around as long as I possibly can. So, again, thank you for inviting us here today, and we're very pleased. So,
I'll
turn it over to Kevin, I believe, is next. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Cannon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Masterson, and I'm the Agency Toxics Coordinator for the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. So my job is to work across our air, water, and land quality divisions on toxics issues and tasked with working on this toxics reduction strategy that we're going to talk about today. And as you know and probably have heard at previous hearings, there are a huge number of chemicals on the open market today. The estimate is about 80,000 chemicals in commerce that are in the Toxic Substances Control Act inventory. And as you can see, we address a relatively small fraction of those chemicals, about 156 regulated by the Clean Air Act, 188 by the Clean Air Act. And so we do try to address other chemicals through voluntary programs and other initiatives, but our resources, of course, are focused a lot on our regulatory efforts. So those acts, those regulations, can't keep up with the production of these chemicals, especially when there are 1,500 new chemicals that are coming out every year. And also, there really isn't a complete hazard information on all of these 80,000 chemicals. The Toxic Substances Control Act does provide some information, but not complete information. So states don't have all of the data that they need to make decisions about what are the highest priority chemicals and how to target their reduction strategies. As you may have heard yesterday, EPA's administrator is proposing reforms to the Toxic Substances Control Act, which could help the states out quite a bit and would influence potentially our strategy that we come up with. So why are we developing this agency-wide toxics reduction strategy? The most obvious reason is that these toxic chemicals don't respect the regulatory boxes that have been created by federal and state legislation. The great example is mercury that gets emitted to the air, deposits to the land, and runs off to the water. And we can give you several other examples like that. So when we're operating within our traditional regulatory framework, we're not solving the entire problem. And so this strategy is designed to make sure that we're integrated across all programs to address those chemicals of concern. It also enables us to get beyond this chemical-by-chemical approach by looking at all of the high-priority chemicals that are out there and developing a comprehensive list of priorities. We can take a much more holistic approach.
Thirdly, it improves the strategy we hope is going to improve the efficiency of the way we use our state resources simply by having better coordination amongst our programs and other state agencies. We'll reduce duplication of effort. We'll be able to leverage the activities of various programs and hopefully actually save resources. And finally, it allows DEQ to be much more proactive than reactive. If we have a strategy that we developed in a logical fashion that has a sound scientific basis, we can sort of point the direction that we need to head in and develop recommendations that hopefully can generate a consensus so that we're not just reacting to whatever next flavor of the month comes forward in the coming year or so. So this graphic just is an illustration of how we, a very simple illustration of how we see this overall toxics reduction strategy functioning. We've got all of these different programs in place. Right now, we could be recommending additional programs or shifting our resources around to address the highest priority pollutants, but these are just some examples of individual programs that we have. We'd like them to come under, all of them come under this umbrella and to be integrated to the extent possible. As you can see, Senate Bill 737 that was passed in 2007 is on this list. We have a toxic use reduction, hazardous waste reduction program for businesses that's been in place for 20 years now that requires them to plan for the reduction of toxics. So we have a lot of good programs in place, and it's really a matter of trying to figure out how we use our resources most effectively to address the highest priority problems. The steps that we've identified for developing the strategy in very short order are listed on this slide. We came up with seven separate steps. We're now on step number two, so we're still somewhat in the infancy of this effort, but we have identified some high-priority toxic chemicals. The next step is to look at these sources and pathways. Where is it coming from, and how is it getting into the environment? That will allow us to tailor our toxics reduction strategies most effectively, look at what we're doing now, and identify where the gaps may be, and then identify new or modified, enhanced programs that can address these toxics of high concern. Then, of course, we need to develop an implementation strategy that has timelines and measurement metrics, because we would like to have environmental measurement outcomes associated with each of the recommendations we make. And we'll have a public comment period. This is not a rulemaking. This is something we're doing of our own accord, but we would like to have a fairly robust public involvement process and present this strategy to our Environmental Quality Commission, and then, of course, implement it soon after. So the timeline, as I mentioned, is pretty ambitious, partly because we're trying to dovetail with other efforts that are going on, like the Senate Bill 737 program, which is prioritizing pollutants as well, and the Water Quality Toxic Standards, which has referenced cross-media needs. So we're trying to maintain some consistency with those other efforts. So hopefully by February we'll have a draft of this strategy and conduct the public involvement after that and finalize the strategies sometime later in 2010. Where are we now in terms of the status? We have an internal team comprised of people from a number of different programs from all three of our divisions, water, air, and land quality, plus our laboratory and assessment division. We're working together very closely along with an external stakeholder group, which has very broad representation from various entities, and it's met three times since June. They're helping us develop the strategy. As I mentioned, we've developed our initial focus list of chemicals, and we're researching the sources and pathways of those chemicals right now. A lot of people have been asking us how we developed this priority list of chemicals, this initial focus list. What we did did was look at 11 existing priority lists that we already have in place or are interagency types of list rather than reinventing the wheel and coming up with a brand new process. You can see some of these lists on the screen right now. These are just examples. The air toxics benchmarks that we're using for our Portland Air Toxics Solutions Program, Senate Bill 737, persistent priority pollutants. We have had a household hazardous waste program priority list that was developed a couple of years ago, and our Willamette Toxics Monitoring Priority Chemicals. So they're monitoring lists, regulatory lists, pollution prevention type lists. Aggregating all of these, we come up with sort of a foundation or a base list of close to 400 toxic chemicals. And when you group them by chemical class, for instance, all of the 30 PCBs that we have on the list, when you lump them together, we end up with about 320 chemicals. This flowchart describes how we're going to go about designating chemicals as high priority and how we're going to evaluate them. As I mentioned, we have an initial focus list, which was developed by taking that base list of 400 chemicals and looking at which ones were a priority for at least three of those 11 programs and across two of our divisions, so that we'd identify high priority cross-media, cross-program chemicals. So that was a programmatic cut, and we came up with about 135, which I'll talk about in just a second. But we realized that the remaining 270 chemicals on that list, on that base list, need to be evaluated in some way, shape, or form. There could be just one program, like air, that has made it a priority, but it could be a significant environmental or public health problem. So we need to develop an evaluation process, which we're doing now. In some cases, there may be no data at all. We've identified some pollutants on the Senate Bill 737 list, which I don't think have been measured at all by anybody. Some musks and fragrances and things like that that we're finding out are fairly persistent. So we need to get more data before we make it a priority for the agency. As I mentioned, we went from about 400 down to 135 when we made this initial cut, and 54 when they're grouped. Again, when you're looking at things like PCBs, PBDEs, the flame retardants, and PEAHs, which are the combustion byproducts, and you lump those together, you're going to get much smaller list. So we divided that list of focus chemicals into seven sort of functional groups: consumer product constituents, current use and legacy pesticides, industrial chemicals like PCBs, the metals, which we have several of on the list, including mercury, volatile organic compounds like trichloroethylene and perchloroethylene, and combustion byproducts. Those are our functional group categories, and we're having folks on our external stakeholder group help us identify sources and pathways of those. So in terms of where the strategy is going to lead, as I mentioned, we're still in the beginning stages of developing this, but we're moving pretty fast, and when we identify recommended actions, we're right now saying everything's on the table. So we could have regulatory and voluntary types of programs, ones that address point and non-point sources, control and source reduction activities, and monitoring and data collection. So a very wide range of things that we want to look at. And again, getting to that that goal of getting beyond the chemical-by-chemical approach, we hope that a number of these solutions that we come up with address multiple priority chemicals. Erosion control is a very good example. If we're able to come up with innovative ways to promote erosion control, we not only keep sediment in place that causes stream impairments, all of those chemicals that attach to sediments, not just one like DDT, but the whole range of legacy pesticides that are persistent, and metals, are going to stay in place and not pollute the water. So we're going to try to identify those to the extent possible. We want to emphasize upstream pollution prevention measures whenever possible. As you all know, preventing a problem is much less costly than cleaning up after the fact. This graphic just shows the life cycle of a chemical, and the way our regulations are set up now, we're at the very end of that life cycle in terms of managing the generation and disposal of pollutants, treatment, incineration, recycling, reuse, all very important tools. But we also need to look at upstream to determine what else we can do to minimize the chemicals that are getting into the environment and affecting public health and ecological receptors. Obviously, those don't apply. Those upstream measures don't apply to legacy chemicals, but many other consumer product constituents. And we are trying to influence purchase and use through household hazardous waste education. And as I mentioned, the business toxic use reduction hazardous waste program we've had in place for the last couple of decades. So to the extent possible, we'll go upstream and look at what those possibilities are. This is an example, just a very simple example of how this strategy will work for a particular pollutant, and this is a disclaimer that these aren't recommended solutions. This is just a straw proposal for one particular pollutant because people want to see an example, in this case DDT, which falls into that legacy pesticide class. You can see that there are a number of sources and pathways, especially erosion from rural lands. And you can see that there are a number of different strategies we can employ in terms of trying to accelerate our TMDL program to address some of these legacy pesticide, working with the National Resource Conservation Council or service to try to get more financial support for erosion control. There's also historical runoff on urban lands. Some of these urban lands used to be rural lands, and it wouldn't be a surprise if there's DDT and legacy pesticides when we do construction projects. So there could be controls there that could be looked at. And finally, spills and leaks from from full containers of some of these old agricultural pesticides. We've been putting on these pesticide collection events for a number of years now and are still getting thousands and thousands of pounds of old pesticides coming in to these events. The final slide I have here is just to give you an idea of what our short-term objectives and opportunities to participate are. The next couple of months are focused on looking at these sources and pathways of chemicals and beginning a gap analysis where we look at how well our programs are doing right now to meet those needs and address those high priority chemicals. We're going to the Environmental Quality Commission in October to do an informational session on toxics. November 17th, you're all invited to come to Toxics Reduction Workshop, where we're going to try to get a number of stakeholders in the room to brainstorm ideas on toxics reduction. The industrial sector, ag, forestry, residential, municipalities, a whole range of folks, and come up with a sort of a foundation list of opportunities that we can then vet. And we'll take the strategy, the draft strategy, to our commission in February and then do public comment over the next 6 months after that and present a final strategy for approval by the EQC. That's all I had.
So my name is Palmer Mason. I'm also with the department. I work as a legislative analyst, and we were asked to provide some information on our current statutory and legal authorities to manage toxins. So these next couple of slides are a very generalized overview of that current legal authority. It's not a definitive legal analysis, but it's intended to give you an idea of what we think our authorities are. And we tried to group this by some of the activities that you might typically manage when you're managing toxic chemicals, things like if they're released and discharged into the environment, if they're being directly used or applied, whether you manage products and toxic chemicals as they're sold, that sort of thing. So that's how we broke down these categories, if you can put that in. And again, just to repeat, the different categories are the release. So we have managing chemicals once they have been released or likely to be released into the environment.
managing toxic chemicals by prohibiting or regulating their direct use or application. The sale would be managing toxic chemicals by prohibiting or restricting their sale, requiring labeling, or directing vendors to supply information to users of those toxic chemicals. And then there's finally the area of content, where you might attempt to manage toxic chemicals by requiring the use of safer alternatives or reducing the levels in products before that item can be sold. So again, those are some ways to approach the management of toxic chemicals. This is a quick graphic that sort of tries to show by way of picture where our authority is broadest at the point of release or discharge. So there again, we're talking about toxic chemicals that have indeed been released into the environment, either through admissions in air, a discharge into water, or through waste products, or they're likely to be released into an environment in one of those ways. Our authority is typically broadest at that point, and then it narrows as you go to these other broad categories. So we have some limited authority to deal with the direct use and application of toxic chemicals. We have very limited specific authority dealing with the sale and the content of either toxic chemicals themselves or items that contain those chemicals. And finally, the last slide is just, again, some conclusions on that. And a couple of points here. I would say DEQ's authority to current statutory authority to manage toxics varies depending on the activity that you're talking about. And again, broadest authority to manage the chemicals as they've been released or have the potential to be released. And we have less authority as you move down to whether you're talking the direct use or application, or the most limited authority is regarding the sale or the content of items.
Palmer, that's really helpful. I want to hear a little more on legal authority. I think most folks are most familiar with the Clean Air, Water Act, Clean Air Act, and that, and as I understand it, is legislation, federal legislation, that gives DEQ the ability to regulate a specified list of toxics. I think it added up to, you know, some 300 some, at their point of release. We're talking about point source, and you do so through permitting programs to try to bring those within acceptable limits. Beyond those federally delegated programs, what additional, I mean, there's clearly additional, you have clearly additional statutory authority to work on toxics reduction, and potentially you're talking about a list that could be hundreds of more toxics. Where do we find that?
Chair Cannon, if I might, I'll take a stab at that, and I'll go further. You're absolutely right that the authority that we get from the Federal Clean Air Act, Federal Clean Water Act, is delegated from EPA, and some of the base is set there in terms of what we regulate and how we regulate it and the levels by which we regulate. Typically, that's transferred from our we get that, and then we write rules and regulations and standards, if you will, that then go back to EPA to make sure that we're implementing that. At that point in time, we could actually be more stringent or add to a list that's given to us, or a direction that's given to us from either the Clean Air Act or the Clean Water Act. With that, another major program that we have is in the land quality arena, where we're delegated the authority or given the responsibility to clean up hazardous waste, tank, and other sites. So those particular cleanups are how we approach those are set in statute and further developed through rule. And those are what we call risk-based standards. In other words, what we do is look at the risk of exposure from where that chemical or toxic is, whether it's in a land, water, or groundwater, and make a determination whether it's an industrial use or a drinking water use or residential use, and we design our cleanup to make sure that we're protecting that particular use. And that is not necessarily constrained by a parameter. It's just constrained by the impact that a release to the environment might cause a risk. And the risk that's set in statute is you can't exceed a hazard index, which is basically an impact on your body that's not cancer of one, which is a term of risk analysis, and then from cancer we have to clean up to a level not to exceed 1 in a million cancer risk. So that's a really broad part of what we do in addition to the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. If I might add, I just want to add to one thing, because one of the things that I think is incredibly important for us to wrestle with and for us to let you know about is that how we're given our programs by the Environmental Protection Agency, how we're budgeted, and everything is really a silo kind of approach. And what we're trying to do with this is really reach out beyond individual medias, whether it be water, air, and land, and really think about toxics holistically and where do we work on areas across program in a way that gets the reductions that we're looking for taken into account, what our obligations are under the different statutes that we're given. And part of that, quite honestly, is a bit of a culture issue within an agency that's been set up the way we're doing it. So we're trying to approach this in more of a holistic way. So without compromising what we're responsible to do under those particular acts. So, and the other thing that I think is important to note is that part of our the pressure that we get, not only from the public, but the people that we regulate, is looking for some certainty in terms of decision making, and the things that they're working on are the right things to protect the environment. So that's an approach that we're taking as well.
Thanks. Let's hear, thank you for your presentation. Let's hear from Gail now on her work of your office on these issues.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members. For the record, I'm Gail Shibley. I'm the administrator of the Office of Environmental Public Health in the Department of Human Services, soon to be part of the Oregon Health Authority as a result of HB 2009 in the last regular session. Appreciate the opportunity to join with my very valued colleagues at Department of Environmental Quality to talk about the broader issue of questions and concerns and approaches perspectives on how we deal with toxics. I think perhaps you have a handout here. Just as we have learned more about chemical substances over the past many years, it's certainly fair to say that we have learned more about human health and development and health risks over the years. It's simply a biological fact that every woman pregnant with a little girl, that little girl is carrying all the eggs that she will ever produce in her lifetime, and consequently the pregnant woman's nutrition, environmental exposures, and other health factors directly impact that granddaughter, if you will, and grandson. And consequently, we are not only concerned about prenatal health, we are also concerned about preconception health. And looking at it from that perspective, we also recognize that the dose doesn't always make the poison. It used to be a mantra, if you will, of toxicological approach that the more you are exposed to something, the greater amount that you are exposed to it, the greater the reaction, the human health impact would be. We are convinced that that's not true for a couple different reasons, and certainly one of them is that as a fetus and as a child is continuing to develop, there are key moments of development that simply can't be repaired once they are impacted in a negative way. And consequently, those, because as I mentioned, that the intergenerational impact, that those have direct and continuing impacts for many generations to come. From a public health standpoint, we have in Oregon statute both very, very broad authority to, quote, directly supervise all matters relating to the preservation of life and health of the people of the state. Boy, that's that's fairly broad. We also have mandates and authority that really are more specific to toxics. One of those is oversight of the Safe Drinking Water Act as it pertains to water systems. Our colleagues at Department of Environmental Quality deal with one part of the Safe Drinking Water Act in terms of underground injection, and we contract with them around source water protection efforts, very important part. But I want to echo what Director Peterson mentioned in terms of the federal EPA programs that are delegated to the states through statute that we are required to have no less than those federal standards covering those federal contaminants. We are certainly allowed to, encouraged to in some ways, examine what fits for individual states, whether to add additional substances and or to increase the protective standards for whatever substances are under regulation. And certainly states have done that for a variety of substances. Perchlorate comes to mind, for example, in drinking water. There are many states that have moved forward on that. The federal government is continuing to study it.
When states do that when they exceed the standard, do they do that by rule? I mean, that's an administrative process, it's not in our statutes that we've identified some additional toxics that we want to add to the list.
Mr. Chair, you could, just as federal legislation identifies specific substances that are required to be regulated, but you don't have to, depending on the authority that's given in the statute. It could well be a formal rulemaking process, absolutely. I'm truly not going to go through these 23 pages, but I just wanted to flag a couple of the categories. As I mentioned, of course, we have very broad general public health authority, both in for ongoing work as well as certainly for emergency work. I do want to bring your attention, for example, should there be an emergency, for example, some of the language, for example, talks about under 431.264, the public health director may, upon approval of the governor, take the public health actions described if the public health director determines that a condition of public health importance has affected more than one county, we can also enter people's property, take or test substances or required that they be taken or tested, etc. More specific to hazardous substances is one that was part of a discussion during the last legislative session, 453.005, which is part of the federal, it's actually the state, I don't want to say counterpart, but it's actually state corollary to the Federal Hazardous Substances Act, which is the purview of the Consumer Product Safety Commission, an independent commission outside of EPA or DHHS or any other executive agency. And this was back in the 1970s, looking at substances that were toxic, corrosive, irritant, strong sensitizer, flammable, combustible, etc. You will see there under 453.0057(e) that previous sessions of the legislature added penta and octa brominated diphenyl ethers as clearly very molecularly specific substances to be banned. Last legislative session, decabrominated diphenyl ether was added to that list, and that's where it will get filed, if you will. There is, I've seen documents from the Federal Consumer Product Safety Commission that articulate that commission's interpretation of these mandates at the federal level and the rules that have been promulgated under these mandates to cover both immediate as well as longer term health related concerns. So there's continuing discussion about how much is acute, what about chronic, and exactly what are the boundaries of the authority under this statute. In addition, we, of course, also have indoor air pollution authority and Well, let me mention one other thing in terms of the hazardous substances. Under this statute, the Director of Human Services, soon to be the Director of Health Authority, has the authority to identify that if something is a hazardous substance or is otherwise susceptible of access by a child, additional measures can be taken, including one requiring some labeling or other information about the hazard. And if nothing else, let's see if I can quote it exactly here, but if nothing else will protect the public, again, particularly children, then it can be banned from commerce. And as I mentioned, I think about a year ago, I think the only time that anybody in our kind of collective institutional memory can recall any action being taken to remove a product from commerce was, I think, lawn darts, to give you an idea of kind of the breadth of that authority. Then indoor air pollution, the statutes there begin on page 15, and all I really want to draw your attention to is there that these are all permissions. None of them are mandates, and they are all, quote, subject to available funds. It's my understanding, after doing a little internal digging within our agency, that there has been no funding for this in about 20 years or so. Can't recall the exact year off the top of my head anymore, but it's been at least 20 years. Then the Safe Drinking Water Act, I've already mentioned to you, and as you well know, there are about 3,600 public water systems in the state. So clearly, if and as we were to identify additional contaminants, that we'd want to make sure we're not in drinking water, keeping in mind that 90% of or 98% of the drinking water systems in the state of Oregon serve fewer than 500 people. We're talking about very small systems all over the state, struggling, frankly, to deal with a lot of the requirements under the 91 contaminants that are regulated by the federal government. And then the last couple pages, 18 and 19, identifies contracts and agreements from the federal government. We get about 80% of funding from the federal government, most in the form of very specific / restrictive grants, contracts, and other agreements to focus on very specific things. Administrator Director Peterson mentioned the hazardous cleanup, hazardous site cleanups in federal law, CERCLA, the Comprehensive Environmental Response and that's terrible. Liability Act, ATSDR, our Agency of Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, is established there, and funding goes through the Department of Health and Human Services at the federal level back down to the state through the Public Health Agency to work with the environmental cleanup folks to do health impact assessments or health consultations around specific sites. There are various restrictions around that frankly are not unique to Oregon. In fact, I am part of a national effort with a variety of states to try to figure out how we can make all of that effort actually meaningful and worthwhile. We find it's actually rather unsatisfactory in far too many cases. And then we do have several handful of contracts and agreements with state as well as Metropolitan Service District in Portland, in the Portland metro area. I will share with you just one last thought that we will never know enough to know that contaminant or substance X equals health effect Y. We are far too wonderfully made as human beings, and we live very complex lives and live for many decades. And consequently, from a public health standpoint, we identify risk factors and work to eliminate or minimize those risk factors everywhere we can. So we are working as closely as we can with DEQ. We are frankly struggling in terms of capacity there because of funding concerns, but we are convinced that we cannot continue to deal with toxic substances one molecule at a time. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Let's see if there are any questions. Are you participating in the DEQ's toxic reductions strategy? Are you coordinated with them on their work?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. We meet very often, both informally as well as formally. I personally am not on a formal committee, but my office is represented, yes.
Just a comment that may say more about my own sort of under-informed state of mind than the status of the law, but it would appear that this is just an extraordinarily complex and non-transparent part of the law, and it raises concern for me. Again, concern perhaps just at my lack of my own lack of understanding. But nothing could be more important to Oregonians than the certainty that their air is reasonably safe, that their water is reasonably safe. And yet, I feel not very well prepared to answer the question: how is the state of Oregon protecting your air and protecting your water? There are the fact that we have two very different agencies, DEQ on the one hand, and your division of the health authority on the other, working on this. The fact that there's a toxic strategy program under development, a sort of umbrella program to try to find the gaps and create links. I mean, I feel like we're in a. I feel like, I guess I can speak only for myself, I feel like we're in a bit of a dark place with respect to this. Not that we're doing badly, but I would like to feel more certain in the answer to those questions about how we're protecting Oregonians' health. So I don't know if you have any comments about that, but that's sort of where this leaves me.
If I might, Chair Cannon, I might not agree that we're in a dark place. What I would say is I think we're in a very much a transition place. The more we're learning about toxics and how people are exposed, the more we're learning that, as I mentioned, just our traditional approach to looking at solving problems may not actually address the outcome that we're achieving. So I'm hoping you're seeing a couple agencies here that are trying to roll up their sleeves, work with the legislature, do what we can to help educate the legislative body on just what you asked is what are the suite of laws that we have to deal with and try to come up with an approach that not only is meaningful to you all, but meaningful to the public, and probably more importantly, leads to the outcome that we're desiring, is to reduce toxics in an efficient, direct way. But I would say we are in an age of transition right now in terms of agencies working together trying to figure this out because of all the uncertainty that you raised. I think it's incumbent upon us to be able to explain that all to you, and we will continue to come to you and try to explain best we can what we have and how we're transitioning to something that's meaningful in terms of not only on paper and words, but also in terms of action.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, yeah, I'd only add that I feel your pain. Not to be glib about it, but it is extremely complex, and frankly, it's very frustrating to try to get a specific answer to a very specific question. I often share with my staff that I feel like we're drowning in data but dying of thirst for information, and we need actionable information to make informed management and executive decisions and be able to provide you the information to help you make inform policy decisions. We are working very closely together. The EQ director and I meet on a regular basis. In addition, our staffs meet on regular basis, as well as just back and forth collaborations all the time. We share information and data and workload and a variety of other things. We don't share a lot of funding, but that's another issue. I want to say that in the relatively short time that I've been the administrator of Environmental Public Health for the past 6.5 years or so, it's only been literally in the last couple handfuls of months where we have been able to provide information to combined committees of the legislature who are focused both on the environment and on human health. And I often feel like I'm the hinge point in between those two. They go to different policy committees, different subcommittees of ways and means. Our budgets end up in different places. We have different, DAS and BAM and other analysts. And that's neither here nor there, except that it makes our work a little more challenging to make sure that you as policymakers have a more complete picture of what's going on and what some of the challenges are.
Chair Cannon, if you'll allow me, just one more thing I want to say, and maybe this might be a little dangerous for a director to say, and I know you're dealing with, in this building, with challenges in terms of resources, and I'm not going to suggest that resources aren't needed to solve these problems, but I will tell you from a director's chair, when we're talking about public health, we're talking about kids and people's and people exposure and clean air and clean water, I don't believe that not having enough money is an excuse to not work on these things. So at least from my chair, you have my commitment that I'm not going to present to the legislature a choice whether, okay, either fund us or we're not going to work on public health matters as it relates to that. How we do that is something that we're going to really have to roll up our sleeves to do, but it's so important that as an agency that has that responsibility, we have to figure out a way to do it with the resources that we have. Hopefully we'll get more, but I understand what you're dealing with.
Thanks. Thank you. With that, let's segue to our last topic, which is the discussion of possible committee bills for 2010. The speaker has asked for our concepts by Monday, I believe, and for committee bills. This does not need to be fully sort of fleshed out and obviously not yet drafted, but possible concepts for 2010 committee bills. My own list is very short, actually, keeping in mind the shortness of the session and the focus that it's likely to have on, appropriately, I think, on really emergent issues and budget issues. There is one of the bills that this committee dealt with during the session, House Bill 2186, that established the low carbon fuel standard, also in its final form established a task force to look at reducing emissions from transportation in our metropolitan areas of the state. And that task force is set to report back to us. They haven't yet met, so they're under they're meeting for the first time next week. So they're under a very short timeline, but they're under the statute, under the enrolled version of 2186, they're required to report back to us with legislation by January 1st, 2010. I still am not clear how the timing of all this is going to work, but the notion is that there may be legislation, recommended legislation, coming out of that task force. So that may be a committee bill for us to deal with. We have some sort of higher powers, and it didn't come to me in church or synagogue, but higher powers are interested in revisiting House Bill 2859, which is a bill we heard in this committee during the legislative session, related to permitted use of water, groundwater, for residential purposes, the sort of exempt well issue, and 2859, I think, proposed reducing the exemption from 15,000 to 1,000 gallons per day for new residential exempt wells. So I expect that
issue may resurface as a committee bill and will be on the list that we propose to the speaker. But I'm interested now, I mean, this is our opportunity to say, here's something else that we should put on that note and flag that we're interested in bringing forward as a committee bill, and I really would entertain any of those ideas that folks may have today. Or maybe they'll all come to us as member bills, which would be fine too. But Representative Smith,
And I don't know how detailed we need to be. How much we can just sort of say, hey, we're going to have this, and kind of work on to see if there's going to be a this. But we might or might not want to have something that that adjusts the water bill. I don't have a particular amendment in mind, but we might want to have a placeholder for that. The second, you might want to have something on efficient public buildings with regard to either the revolving fund question or some other question. Maybe it specifically is with regard like cool classrooms and school buildings. And third, and this is the most controversial, but would we want to have a biomass compromise bill be considered by this committee? And I do not have one in mind. I would not plan on having one as a member bill. But it might be something to consider.
Great, and I also don't know. I'll meet with the speaker later today. I don't know what level of detail he's looking for. I, too, have been thinking about all of those subjects, but have gotten no farther than possible adjustments to the water bill that we may find we need and need quickly, a notion that it would be great to be looking into this public buildings
right.
topic. But I... similarly, haven't gotten much further than that. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In relationship to the water bill, there's one possible type of amendment or issue that may need to be discussed. And it has to do with some timing in relationship to the bonds that might go, not the initial bonds from the lottery bonds, but the general obligation bond. This may have been somewhat solved since the treasurer has opted to sell the lottery bonds earlier, which will therefore allow a little earlier start than had been necessarily anticipated by the folks in the district. But that might be an issue that we need to look at. Obviously, nobody wants to incur a debt load, the state or the borrower until such time as we're ready to use the money, for that debt load. So I just bring that up today, and I will keep you appraised of the status of that as I visit with people over the next month here. Before our next meeting, I should have a little more specific information for you, or I'll get it to you as soon as I have.
Would you like us to indicate in a line or two to the speaker that this may be the subject of a committee bill?
Yeah. Okay.
We'll do that.
Yeah.
Representative Barker.
Thank you. I would add just one consideration to what Representative Jensen said. The other consideration, of course, being the point at which the treasurer is able to market the bills because of the window that opens up in an unsettled credit market. Otherwise, I agree completely with what you've said.
Thank you. Representative Boone.
I'm having bill drafted for the 2010 session. A redo of the ocean renewable energy as an unknown percentage of the RPS. And it's being reviewed by OWET and by, Justin Clure, talked to him at the Wave Energy Conference, and also hope to get some input from some of the other people in the Department of Energy. But I would be very happy if you wanted to have that be a committee bill. I'm not, it doesn't have to be all about me. And it would fit this committee really well, I think.
I agree, and I'm also very interested in the subject, and if there's a way to make it work as a committee bill, and that saves your member bill potentially for something else, then I think we should pursue that. So let's talk.
Yeah, it was drafted ready to drop last year, and OWET asked me, Stephanie Thornton, who was directing OWET at the time, asked me to hold off because they were just putting out, they just had put out an RFP for their market utility market initiative, which should be finished by December. And it's being done now. It was reported on at the Wave Energy Conference that OWET put on in Seaside earlier this month. And the people who, I mean, it's ready to go. It's very light right now because it doesn't name the percentage. But the rapidity with which that sector is moving forward is it's just unbelievable. It's way farther than I thought. I'm going to be traveling a couple times this next month to a couple of different conferences that will bring me up to speed, and stuff that is happening right now that will be reported on in the end of this month. We're in October. And then I will have a little better idea of what's out there. But we are even experiencing some people who are for example, Tillamook County receives some ERA money to repair the jetty. And while you're doing the repair work, you may as well put a energy device on it if you can. And we had a couple of representatives from a company in Norway go down the coast a couple weeks ago now, and we'll come back and meet the Port Commission, Garibaldi, the County Commission. The meeting's been put together now for a little bit later. But it's moving quickly, and if we can get something in the water, we can, I mean, I don't even know what they can produce, but I think we're finding ourselves well on our way, and as we heard today, we might already be there, even close to it. And so the number that we'll be choosing will need to reflect some of what's available out there.
Well, I'm very interested in working on the issue, and I think, again, this is a case where there's nothing to lose by indicating to the Speaker that this may be a topic that we want to deal with as a committee. And, of course, as we introduce committee bills, there will be a vote in January on that, but typically has been a vote that doesn't, you know, reflect on our eventual position on the issue. It just simply gets that bill in the process. And I don't think I'm, you know, contradicting the intention of the Speaker to suggest that, you know, a committee bill is that gets on this list is likely one that we'll at least introduce and then see what happens.
What I'll need to know then is whether or not to introduce it as my, right, you know, individual bill,
right,
or wait and see what you guys do. So
yeah. Thanks. Any other thoughts, Representative Thompson?
Representative Schaffler and I are dusting off the forest biomass bill. I don't know if that's going to be within the purview of this committee, but we're doing it mostly to make work for Representative Barnhart.
We'd welcome it.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. Any other suggestions for this list? Well, we will keep you apprised and be returning to probably more focused work with these issues in November. We'll also get an update of the working with Representative Cowan on an update to the NOAA process in Newport and the huge lift that community is experiencing due to NOAA's decision to relocate the fleet there. So we'll get a status report on that. And if you have other suggestions for the agenda, please don't hesitate to be in touch. Again, I think our work between in the remaining meetings before February, November, and our January meeting will be probably more focused on our February topics than our 2011 topics, but we'll want to continue to kind of move forward on our thinking for 2011 too. So as those ideas come to mind, please be in touch. Seeing nothing, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, just as a matter of apology to you and the members of the committee and to the audience, my apologies for running in and out today. I've been monitoring
my other committee that I'm in, while I'm in here and when I'm in there, I'm monitoring the committee that is what's taking place in here. So I've tried to be in two places at the same time throughout the entirety of this, and if it's been disruptive for anyone, or if anybody in the audience thinks I haven't been interested in your topics, that's certainly not the case.
Representative Jensen, you've always done twice the work as the rest of us.
This only winds up being half of the work, because I only get half the information that I really need to get.
Well, and speaking of that, I don't think you get twice the per diem, but I am asked to request that members be sure to fill out their per diem forms and turn in to the clerk's office. Do we have to do that every day that we're in?
No. It's
just once per.
It's on your desk on the floor.
You know what? I think they've moved them. They're on your door, your office door.
Oh, okay.
Now.
Thank you.
So
on the office door?
That's what they said.
I assumed I wasn't going to die, so I went ahead and said I was here all 3 days. And this is the last day.
Any public comment? No one was signed up. I think so. With that, we will close the informational meeting and close the Environment and Water Committee.